Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Welcome. This is, as I hope all of you know, if there are any attorneys in here and you think that this is for depositions, you're in the wrong room. We are an attorney's office, a law office. But this is the TAP for pulmonary outcome measures, and we're very pleased to have everyone here for our meeting this morning. And I think we're going to start basically with introductions. And so I'm going to ask everybody to go around and tell us your name, obviously, where you're from, what kind of work you do that you think would be related to outcome measures and quality improvement and things like that. And maybe after lunch we'll do another quick round and you can tell us one exciting thing about you that you think everybody should know but they don't. But we won't start quite that way this morning. It's probably too early. I'm Barbara Yarn. I'm a family physician. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. No, I do not work at the Mayo Clinic. I work at the other group in town, which is a group of 140 physicians, mainly primary care. I do research full-time and have for several years now, so I'm the director of research there. Have been involved in lots of guidelines panels and was involved on the expert review panel for asthma, so and am becoming a part of the GOLD group, I think, in they haven't decided if it's June or July, but sometime like that is the next year. So I'm very excited to be here. I get the name chair, which is one of those figurehead things that I just sit up here and smile, and Riva and Alexis and Karen do all the work. But we'll try to move things along. The other thing I just wanted to mention while I'm doing the introduction is, as you know, when we develop something, all of us have tremendous ownership of it, and it becomes part of us. And so we will be the same as people are when they're on study session, necessarily critical, but always positive. Mm-hmm. And so that's how our comments will be. And so we'll work on that. Why don't we go ahead and, Alexis, since everybody knows you, but tell us who you are anyway.
Good morning. I am Alexis Foreman. I am the project manager for the Patient Outcomes Project, and you've received lots of emails from me and lots of information. So now you know you're able to put the face with the name. And thank you all for coming this morning. And thank you for all your hard work thus far.
I'm Richard O'Connor. I'm from San Diego. I'm with the Sheriff Resealy Medical Group. We are a group of about 400 physicians. I'm chief of the division of asthma there, and I'm also head of the Department of Quality Management. I've been involved in quality improvement, quality management for about 18 years now. I'm also a member of the NCQA's Respiratory Measurement Advisory Panel.
I'm Hugo from a highly integrated healthcare system in San Diego to Dallas, Texas, which is the bastion of the last standing angry individual. I think a long range of ahead of healthcare is where I am at Baylor University Medical Center, which is sort of the flagship hospital of the Baylor healthcare system, different from Baylor and Houston. I'm the medical director of a tertiary care referral center for asthma, COPD, pulmonary rehab, and have done a lot of work with outcomes with pulmonary rehab in terms of water and land, developing water and land-based programs, as well as worked with the Dallas Public Schools recently, published an article on children with asthma in Dallas in 2003, did not miss more school than kids without asthma. And we think that's, and that certainly was a sea change of opinion, but I think points out the possibilities of an aggressive and proactive school system. But anyway, I get to take care of patients and to dabble and to read that and asthma and have a lot of fun at it.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Lisa Richardi. I'm with British Excellence and Community Training System. I'm with the Central Branch. and we are developing a payment reform system in which we are differentiating typical and reliable care from what we call potentially avoidable complications. So when the call for patient outcomes measures came out, somebody recommended that maybe our potentially avoidable complications would serve as patient outcome measures. So that's what I'm presenting. My background is I'm a cardiothoracic surgeon by training. I trained at Mayo. So I'm a cardiothoracic surgeon. And I trained to be a heart transplant surgeon as well as a bypass surgery and some pulmonary surgery. But my main focus now has been in patient quality and outcomes for the last 11 years.
Good morning. I'm Larry Hamm, and I'm here representing the AACDPR, which is, you ready for this now, the American Association of Cardiovascular and Pulmonary Rehabilitation, which is why we call ourselves the AACDPR. And my day job is just down the street teaching at George Washington University. I'm a professor there in the Department of Exercise Science in the School of Public Health and Health Services. And have about, before teaching, have about 25 years of clinical experience out in cardiac and pulmonary rehabilitation programs.
And our goal in the future is to have you say pulmonary and cardiac rehab.
Okay. I'm not offended in the least.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jareen Baldock. I'm an associate clinical professor at Ohio State University. I'm also a member of the board of directors of AACDPR and have served as one of the co-authors with others on the measures that we brought forward to the committee today. My clinical background, I've been a nurse for almost 30 years now, and then the clinical background includes pulmonary rehabilitation, coordination, lung transplant coordination, home health care nursing. And I served as the Nursing and Allied Health Representative on the ACCP AACDPR Pulmonary Rehabilitation Guidelines that were published in CHEST in 2007.
Thank you. Emma?
Hi. My name is Edna Nakamavis. I'm a research analyst at NQX and looking forward to hearing the conversation today.
And before any of us leave today, we have to be able to say your last name three times fast.
And there's a trick. It's not that hard. The first syllable is knock, like you're knocking.
Uh-huh.
Mauve, like the color, although depends how you pronounce it. Mauve, it, and then
I
mauve. Yeah.
Okay. And you wore mauve today to help us.
Yeah.
We appreciate your help. Margaret.
My name is Margaret Ness. I'm a pulmonary and critical care physician at Harbor View Medical Center, which is the county hospital for the University of Washington. I do most of my clinical work in pulmonary and then predominantly critical care. And I have done ARDS and sepsis clinical trials. And because of that, interest went on and did some master's work in epidemiology. So in the distant kind of cobwebs in my brain are some wonderful statistician sort of skills, but mostly now doing critical care, and then for the last couple of years have been serving as associate medical director for critical care, so in that role have really been building on quality improvement protocols, you know, sort of building consensus, and throughout the whole hospital. So
hi, I'm Karen Pace, and I'm on NQF staff. I'm one of the senior program directors. And the reason I'm here is I was director for a hospital outcomes project that is winding down, we hope. And also I've been working with our consensus standards approval committee on the evaluation criteria and measure submission forms and those kinds of things.
Yeah. I'm Rita Winkler. Welcome, everyone. I am the senior advisor for the patient outcomes project, of which this is a part. My background, I've been at NQF for almost 9 years now, and so I've done any number of projects and any number of topic areas, and it's quite possible I keep running into old friends as we, you know, regroup committees all the time. But thank you all for coming. I'll be helping guide you through the process within the context of a larger project. We're going to explain to you how this fits in with the larger project, as Alexis sort of does in the intro. A couple of things, like comments I'd like to make. Due to the expertise on this committee and the measures we had in this committee is actually sort of pulmonary / ICU, because it seemed to be the best fit. So just keep in mind it was because of you that combination happened. And in more practical details, just recall, I don't know if you've seen Donald and our transcriber in the back, but this meeting is both being recorded and transcribed. Both the transcripts and the recording will be posted on NQF's public website. So realize you are definitely on the record, as well as summaries that will be made. So just, you know, fair warning on that. So again, my thanks to all of you for coming to Team Trek. I know some of you have come a long way to come be with us, so hopefully we can make this a very productive meeting and draw on all of your expertise to help us get the best outcome of this project possible.
In addition to the more ICU, we do have, as you probably noticed, we do have from primary to tertiary care, and that was also very intentional because it's the full spectrum of care, too. So, he's going to go ahead, and Alexis is going to give us a background.
Yes. Okay. So, the goals of the meeting today is to, one, get an orientation, a background on what NQF is, what do you do, and what's currently going on at NQF. We're also going to go over the outcomes project as a whole so you can understand how you fit within this large project and the work plan. Then we're going to discuss the evaluation criteria that you all have been working on when you were reviewing the measures. We're also going to start to begin to review the 7 candidate measures that you all were assigned. And then hopefully if we have time, and if not, we'll have to have a conference call to discuss any gaps in outcome measures as far as pulmonary conditions.
And I should tell everybody before, and I'm going to apologize immediately. I got a call this morning and my flight was, the one I was going to go on at 7-something was canceled, and so I'm leaving on a 4 o'clock flight, which means I'm leaving here at 2:15, and I apologize ahead of time, but I couldn't stay overnight another night. So we will be moving briskly through, and probably we'll have to do something by telephone, perhaps some of the gap identification and other things, but hope we get through all of the 7 majors before I have to leave.
Just please excuse us, Donald is working on trying to get the phone line in. We're expecting some folks calling in, particularly some of the major developer representatives to have available for us, but we're having some technical issues in terms of making that phone connection, so that background I apologize for, but he's trying to fix it so we can have those folks join us.
So. Sorry, after all those interruptions,
would you like to focus on what we're talking about? Sorry. So NQF is a private, nonprofit, voluntary assisted setting organization. We have over 400 members currently, and those 400 members are organized into 8 councils, which represent the stakeholder perspective within our healthcare system. Our NQF structure, we have a board of directors, which oversees the entirety of the project. We have a consistent standards approval committee, which approves the standing committee's proposed standards. So when the standing committee decides to recommend certain measures for endorsement, they then go to the CSAC, and the CSAC approves that endorsement. And the CSAC also acts as sort of like an assistant committee to the board of directors. So they assist the board of directors with policies and procedures within NQF. We also have a national priorities partnership, and that was convened in 2008 by NQF. And we currently have, I think, 32 organizations that sit on this committee. And their goal is to improve our healthcare system. So they have come up with priorities and goals and come up with some action items and ways to improve our healthcare system. And then we also have a leadership network which consists of our 8 council chairs that represent the stakeholder perspective of the healthcare system. So that's just some brief background on our current structure in EQS. This slide, we just wanted to show you our new website. And when you come to our website, this is your actual first page that you'll see. So I don't know if some of you have been going back and forth to our website, but we recently got a new website, so we just wanted to show you our new page.
The other thing about the website is how it says over on the site, enroll now.
Anybody.
Any public person can enroll. And what that does is allow you to set up your own dashboard of things of interest within NQF, such that if you know you just want to follow this project, you log in, this stuff all pops up in, as opposed to scrolling through everything else we might be doing. And so that allows you to individualize it. So I'd encourage you to check that out.
And also our department, the Department of Performance Measures, if you look at the second tab, Measuring Performance, that's how you find out information about what's going on in our department, our current project. And you would also see our patient outcomes target page by clicking on that tab. Okay, so AQF has a threefold mission. Our mission is to improve the quality of American healthcare by setting national priorities and goals for performance improvement, endorsing consensus standards for measuring and public reporting on performance, and promoting the attainment of the national goals through education and outreach. Some of our strategic goals is to become the primary standards used to measure quality of healthcare in the U.S. Also, to become the principal body that endorses national healthcare performance measures, quality indicators, and/or quality of care standards. NQF will increase the demand of high-quality healthcare, as well as be recognized as the major driving force for and facilitator of continuous quality improvement of the American healthcare system. So this slide talks about our growth and our portfolio of measures. So we're looking for measures that are needed for pay-for-performance programs, and also measures that are addressing the gaps, and we'll go into more detail about that when we look at our criteria as far as importance. We're also looking at disparity-sensitive measures as well as measures of patient experience in multiple settings. And also cross-cutting areas, which is actually a part of our patient outcomes project. We're looking at cross-cutting measures, so non-condition-specific measures. Some key issues for our current NQF portfolio: do we have too many, do we have too few, and do we have the right measures currently for all of the conditions? Our availability of data sources, as well as the transition to electronic health records, which is currently a big issue at AQF. Our current health IT department is working hard, and Reba can talk more about that as far as our quality data sets.
I just want to mention, NQF over the last 10 years has endorsed, we're now over well over 500 measures. And this is not a static set, but a growing and evolutionary set. And so we're constantly trying to, you know, look at the measures in the portfolio to ask, you know, which ones still belong there, what are the new ones, what are the, you know, how have things progressed. Measures that were okay maybe 5 years ago probably aren't as good for us today, and we're looking for other things. That's probably the underpinning for this entire outcomes project, is there has been an evolution in thinking. The idea of patient outcomes, measuring patient outcomes as quality and performance measures, has been a little unsettling, certainly in the early years of NQF, and so we saw a growth of a lot of process measures. But there's been an incredible change in thinking and in all stakeholder groups about the benefit of outcome measures. And so moving into that realm of outcomes is part of this evolutionary process of finding the better measures. So we are constantly remodeling that portfolio to add better, more robust measures and to weed out the ones that either no longer perform, never did much to help drive quality improvement, or are just not as good as perhaps other measures. So it's an ongoing process that this is very much sort of in the forefront of.
One question for you, in along the lines of sort of that strategic goal of being sort of the primary driver, what percent, just at a gut level, would you say of those 500 or even the last, say, year or two worth have really taken hold to the point that it is the primary driver? Where do you think you are in that
section? That's a good question. It's actually something we're doing a very formal evaluation of to find out the amount, the measures that are being used. There are a variety of them. A lot of our ambulatory care measures are picked up in CMS's PQRI project. Our some of our perinatal measures are now being implemented by the Joint Commission. Most of the measures come through, or a lot of the measures coming through our hospital project you find posted on CMS's Hospital Compare. So I haven't done, you know, I can't give you a percentage or numbers, but and the thing that I think is the real unknown is the fact that we get lots of questions from people, sometimes on numbers, sometimes not, on projects because they're implementing them within their hospital, their system, they have questions about them. So there's a lot of use out there that's a little hard to track because it isn't something that's big and maybe done in a very local way. And so we're struggling with trying to figure out the best way to get that information so we have a better understanding of how widespread the use is. But I do find it amazing questions I get from folks saying, well, we're using your measures, but we've got a question on X. And so we have to figure out a better way to keep track of that, you know, less formal use, if you will, or that local use.
So at HLF, we're driving towards higher performance, and we're also looking more at submitting or getting measure developers to submit composite measures. We do have a few composite measures submitted for this project. None under pulmonary specifically, but we do have a couple of composite
measures. Define a composite measure for us, please. What is a composite measure?
Let me do it. A composite measure is some combination of individual measures combined in, you know, there are a variety of methodologies for combining them. One of the classics is all or none, but others may be weighted averages. But so that measures are in some fashion combined to have a summary score. And so
they could be across either intermediate or true outcomes. Or do you have any that are across conditions?
I don't believe so at the moment. It'd be nice if
they could. They're more conditions.
They're more conditions.
But some of them have combined process outcomes.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's what I wanted to define. That it composites ever include more than one condition, because when you're taking care of people with COPD, for example, they don't have one.
It's not restricted, it's just I don't think we've seen any of them. What kind of measures
for you? Will now be placed in the conference.
There's some significant complexity in developing a measure like that, but it certainly would not be out of bounds.
Okay, thank you.
We're also looking at harmonization with our measures, with our current measures that are in our current portfolio, as well as measures that we will put forward for endorsement. So harmonization around age, things of that nature. So we're trying to do a better job of making sure that our measures are consistent within certain parts of the specification. We're also looking to promote shared accountability and measurement across patient-focused episodes of care. As far as outcome measures, appropriateness measures, a cost and resource. So our quality and severity measurement and reasons you can help me out with this. We're looking at an assessment of quality by race, economic status, ethnicity, primary language, and we want that to become a part of our performance measurement. We're also want these to We would like to explore direct methods for collecting this information that is efficient and effective. So we're also looking to identify disparity-sensitive measures that I mentioned earlier.
Just one comment. One of the things that is an important issue around the topic of disparities is when we look at risk adjustment methodologies and the risk factors, what's included and what's not. There are some fairly strong opinions among the NQF membership of, you know, whether, you know, not to include you know, some of the classic race, ethnicity, SES kinds of things that could sort of get buried in the midst of an adjustment methodology. So we'll talk more about that, but that would be an important thing to look, consideration to look at and note within any of the risk adjustment methods.
And here we have an episode framework that we recently did in QF, and this is just an example of the QMI.
Yeah, the episode of care framework is something that's growing. MenQF has been started with an overall framework and then is applying it to various very common conditions. And this is known as the ANCA bubble diagram, and it's fine. I actually go to conferences now and see our own bubble diagrams presented by other people, so it's making its way out there. In terms of trying to look at what is an episode of care, looking at, you know, populations at risk, patients that actually have acute and then post-acute and secondary symptomatology, and, you know, where the episode would begin might be different for different conditions, whether acute like acute MI or chronic like diabetes. But this is a concept that is a lot of folks have embraced for a lot of different ways of trying to describe something more than the point in time, single visit kind of approach to measurement and assessment of quality and performance.
At some point in time, you might, and not today, but you might want to explain why you don't use what has been for many years a standard epidemiology terminology of tertiary prevention and choose two kinds of secondaries. But we won't go there today. Please.
I'll let Elliot explain that to you.
Uh-huh. Good.
As I mentioned earlier, NTP, so NTP has several priorities that they're looking to work with different stakeholders within our healthcare system to improve our healthcare system. So the first one is engage patients and families in managing health and making decisions about care. Improve the health of the population. Improve the safety and reliability of America's healthcare system. Ensure patients receive well-coordinated care across all providers, settings, and levels of care. Guarantee appropriate and compassionate care for patients with life-limiting illnesses, and eliminate waste while ensuring the delivery of appropriate care. And this was a part of the evaluation form that we all had to fill out, and staff looked at these priorities and the specific goals under each of these priorities to see if the measures actually fit the goals. It's okay if the measure doesn't, but in QF we're working to make sure that we endorse measures along those NPP priorities and goals.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
We would prefer that asthma is not a life-limiting one, especially in children. No, it's one of our measures we looked at with asthma in children.
And this is the same framework, and what we did, we took those priorities and matched it along the different phases within this framework. Okay, now a little bit more about our patient outcomes project. It's being funded by the Department of Health and Human Services, and we're focusing on the Prop 20 Medicare conditions in which 95% of the expenditures, Medicare, are being spent on these specific conditions. So we're looking to improve the outcomes for patients to reduce readmissions or to improve the health of the patient. We're also looking to expand into the current portfolio of outcome measures.
Just to mention, when HHS came to us to start this proposal going, their focus was the top 20 Medicare conditions. However, in response, we broadened it a little bit in some areas, asthma being one of them, because that doesn't fit the top 20 Medicare list, but certainly is a huge thing for everybody else. So there are, it's not just those plus a few things where we started to expand some of the boundaries that were logical and made sense. So that's where the asthma comes in for this particular group. There are a couple of others, but I just, in case anybody was wondering about asthma.
So these are our conditions for this project. We're broken up into three phases, since there are some main conditions that we're focusing on. And you're a part of phase one, the pulmonary tap, and we'll be looking at asthma measures, COPD measures, as well as some ICU-related measures. We currently have 8 taps total for this project, and we have 3 total steering committees. For phases 1 and 2, they share 1 steering committee, and for phase 3, mental health has a steering committee, and child health has a separate steering committee. But phases 1 and 2 have 8 taps total. So you're the first tap to actually meet. So, you're a trial and error.
We didn't sign it in consent form. I'm not sure we should be swimming.
Exactly.
What do you mean? No IRB. No, our physicians and nurses are human. We don't count.
Get away.
So we also have a cardiovascular tab that will be looking at CAD, MI, heart failure, stroke, AFib. We have a diabetes metabolic tab. And then in phase 2, we have a bone and joint tab, a cancer tab, GI tab, infectious disease, and eye care tab. And then phase 3 will be looking at mental health, depression, Alzheimer's, and then child health as a whole. Child health is pretty broad. It's not limited. So our project goals are to endorse additional measures suitable for public reporting and quality improvement. And we're looking at, again, cross-cutting measures, so non-condition-specific measures, as well as the measures within those conditions that I just named. We're also looking to identify gaps in measurement, so we're going to look to you all as our TAP members, as well as our steering committee, to come up with or recommend potential outcome measures to fill those gaps.
Just to mention, these goals actually are fairly equal. This particular group has a reasonable number of measures to evaluate, but there are certainly other types of outcome measures of interest, and the steering committee has sort of created a bit of a framework of the different types of outcome measures, and once we get through the measure evaluation part of it, we'll want to have a discussion about potential, what might an outcome measure look like around functional status for COPD and for asthma? How might an outcome measure look for adverse outcomes, things like that. And that's an important part of it because it will form an agenda that is very eagerly sought by some of the other activities we have under this very large HHS contract that we have, but also HHS itself. I talk with them twice a month for fun. This is an important aspect of it because they're in a position to direct some of the resources within the federal government to create some of these measures that are desirable. So they are looking for that agenda as well. So your input will be very important as we sort of build that. What are the measures that are really needed but we don't have yet?
All of our projects go through what we call a consensus development process, and it's to make sure that we're looking and receiving views from all stakeholders within our healthcare system. So that's why we have a multi-stakeholder membership, and what we try to do on our steering committees and TAPs, where possible, we try to have at least one representative from each stakeholder in healthcare. So consumers, providers, health professionals, purchasers, community and public health agencies, supplier and industry organizations, health plans. We try to make sure that we get everyone's opinion because we want it to be a consensus. And also, as you know, our formal endorsement is voluntary. We're not going to have to use these measures. They're pure voluntary consensus measures. So this is our part of our consensus development process, and as you can see, you're highlighted in yellow, technical advisors or panels and workshops. So what happens is we get a project. We start our project up by having a call for intent. So this call for intent is mainly geared toward merger developers to say, hey, we have a new project. We'd like for you to let us know if you would like to, if you plan on submitting to this project, if you have any measures that fit within the scope of our project. And then we have a call for nominations and a call for measures. The call for measures for this project was broken up into 2 call for measures, one for phase 1 and one for phase 2, and that was again because we had so many conditions. Our call for nomination is how we created this TAP, as well as our other 7 TAPs and our main steering committee. And then, after we had our call for nominations and our call for measures, we received our measures, we selected our TAP and steering committee, and here we are today reviewing the measures that were submitted. So, after this meeting, we'll meet with the other 7 TAPs, and then the main steering committee will come together and review your recommendations and rationales behind the measures that you review, and they will come to a consensus as a steering committee and propose consensus measures to be approved or endorsed by NQF.
And I am the liaison to that steering committee, so it won't be just what the written things are that I will be there to be able to give them some context in addition to the staff being there. So,
you're right. Barbara's not a liaison, she's actually a full member of the committee.
Okay, I'm a member of the committee.
Voting power.
Wow, okay.
So once the steering committee puts forth the measures that they think should be recommended for endorsement, we will draft a report and we will go out for NQF member and public comment. And the draft report will be listed on our website and anybody can comment, and that's a 30-day period. Once we receive all of our comments from the recommendations from the steering committee, the steering committee will then meet together for a conference call to review those comments. And at that time, we will go through the major concerns or the major comments that we have, and we will propose action responses to each of the comments that were submitted. Once we do that, we then draft or re-edit our report if there were any changes. Sometimes what happens is there are comments saying, well, oh, you didn't recommend this measure, and these are the reasons why you should have recommended this measure. These are the reasons why you shouldn't, either based on scientific evidence or guidelines such as that nature that the steering committee or the TAB didn't think of or didn't necessarily know. So then after we look at the comments, we have the conference call, we then go to voting. And this is a 30-day voting period where our NQF members vote on the measures that the steering committee has recommended for endorsement. And then once that closes, after that 30-day period, we then go to our consensus standards approval committee that I was talking about earlier. And then they approve the proposed endorsed standards that the steering committee would like NQF to endorse.
And CSAC is essentially a subcommittee of the board. The action of putting the final endorsement was something that was directly a board action, but it just sort of overwhelmed them with the amount of work, so they created the subcommittee to do sort of a lot of the heavy lifting for them. They then ratify the recommendations of the CSAC.
And then once you have that board ratification, we have a 30-day appeal at that time where anyone can submit a letter to NQF if they didn't get a chance to get their voice heard, or if they have some concerns about the endorsed measures. So your role as a TAP member, you will provide technical input to the steering committee regarding the sub-criteria within that evaluation form and within that evaluation criteria, and that's what you all have been working on. You were assigned measures, and there was a primary reviewer and a secondary reviewer, and we'll be going over that information. Also, our chair, Dr. Yon, will sit on the steering committee, and she will represent the TAP. She will be the vote for the TAP. And for this project, as we said previously, we will work with you to come up with suggestions on gaps in measurement and recommendations on what measures are that aren't out there that should be out there and should be endorsed. Our role as NQF staff, we're here to achieve the goals of the project and to make sure that we get through the consensus development process. We will all organize all meetings and conference calls. We will make sure you get the information that you need in order to review the measures. We will make sure that you get through the steps of the CDP as well as adhere to NQF policies and procedures. We will draft all of the reports, and we'll make sure that you send everything out to you before we close it to make sure that we have collected your voice. and we will also ensure communication amongst all project participants, including the steering committee, the measure developers. Okay. Now we will look at the measure evaluation criteria, and Karen has been deeply involved in this. And so our new criteria was approved by the board in August 2008, and this new criteria is strengthened our endorsement criteria as well as clarifies some issues. And so what we're looking for now, like I said earlier, is having a greater measure harmonization. We're also looking for more outcome measures, and with our project measures, we're looking for that link between the process and outcome measures. So this is a table that shows our old criteria and some of the new changes from our new criteria. Our importance to measure, with our measures now, the measure must pass the importance criteria in order to move forward to be reviewed for scientific acceptability, feasibility, and usability. If it doesn't pass the importance criteria, the measure stops there, and it's not, it will not be reviewed for potential endorsement by NCREF. Our feasibility, we now have a greater emphasis on health IT, and our usability, we have a greater emphasis again on harmonization. And Karen, did you want to add anything?
Not right now. Okay. Okay.
Our conditions for consideration, and these are the four steps that the NQF staff completed before handing off the measure to you. So we look to make sure that we have an intellectual property agreement signed, and if it's in the public domain, they, of course, don't have to have that agreement. We also look to make sure that there is someone responsible for this measure and that the measure will be updated and maintained. We also have to make sure that no matter what, a measure both is used for public reporting and quality improvement, not one or the other, but both. And we looked to make sure the measure submission form is complete and the information is there that is needed for you all to be able to review it to the highest potential. Also, generally, we like for our measures to be fully developed and tested. However, it's okay if they have not been tested. If the measure moves through the process, the CDP, and it's recommended for endorsement, it's only allowed a time-limited endorsement because it has not been tested, because we don't have those test results. And the measure developer must complete testing within 24 months. So we do have a couple measures within our patient outcomes project in which they will only be eligible for a time-limited endorsement because that testing has not been completed.
I'm just going to say that's changing a little bit in the very near future, and we'll have to see what impact it has on this project. But generally, the board, I think, discussed this week not making time-limited endorsement available for outcome measures because outcome measures are so complex, outcome or composite measures. So we'll have to give you an update on that. But if there are any of the measures today untested? I don't think so. So we'll have to, you know, provide you an update.
But it doesn't seem to apply since we don't have any untested measures.
And this is just a brief overall view of our timeline. Our selection of our tasks is still ongoing. We're wrapping that up. So we should have our final proposed rate out for our 14-day comment period within the next week. The main steering committee met in October, the 19th and 20th. And the scope of that meeting was to come up with the scope of the project, to get familiar with the project, to get familiar with our measure eval criteria and our measure evaluation form, as well as at that time we were still doing some outreach to receive vendors for this project. So they did an excellent job on providing us with suggestions and avenues on how to solicit for more measures for our project. In phase one, we have three tasks. So the CAS will meet from December through January, and like I said, you're our first CAS to meet. And then for phase two, we have 5 CAS, and they'll meet from January to March. Then once all of our CAS meet and they've come up with their recommendations and rationale, the main steering committee will meet to review your strengths and weaknesses and your rationale behind your ratings for each of the sub-criteria. They'll meet on the 20th and 21st of April. And then if they get through all the measures at that time, we'll begin to get ready for our comment period. But they will, between April, either that meeting or, you know, conference calls later, they will decide on which measures they would like to recommend for endorsement. We hope to have our comment period begin in June of 2010, and then our member voting in August with the board ratification in late October. And this timeline could be changing, but as of right now, this is how we like our project. So, okay. So let's talk about...
How are you doing? Oh,
we're almost done.
10 minutes.
10 minutes max.
Okay.
So we
I think that, you know, if you have something like that, they can read a lot of it. So.
Okay.
So
we can skip through some things?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm not saying you should skip right now.
We can skip to the evaluation process.
That would probably be okay, I think, isn't it?
So as we all said, that the CAT members will evaluate the sub-criteria for the condition-specific measures, and the full steering committee will evaluate the measures and vote. For measures that pass importance, which for this project, it kind of seems like because we have so many conditions that it's already passed important, we know that the conditions that we're looking at are valuable within our healthcare system. So again, the steering committee votes on the recommendations for endorsement. So our 4 main criteria are importance to measure and report, scientific acceptability, usability, and feasibility. So important to measure, we're looking for, is this measure important enough for resources for measurement and reporting? Is there opportunity for improvement? Is there a current gap or is there a high impact within our healthcare system? And do we have the evidence to support why this measure is important? And again, in order for this measure to move throughout the process, it must pass the importance criteria. For scientific acceptability.
And the fact that the staff decided it passed the importance criteria doesn't mean that we have to say we agree completely. We could say we think it's pretty important, but maybe not the highest level because you're going to get to the grades. Is that correct? Okay.
And let me just clarify, staff don't usually make that decision. So I think what Alexis was saying that in general, these outcome measures and the fact they relate to the priority conditions probably indicates that they will pass that criterion, but it is your review and decision.
So, well, that, you know, you look at it and said, well, blood pressure control is not a good outcome criteria for asthma. You would have thrown that out, for example. I'm just using a wild example.
I don't know that we would have thrown that out. That probably still would have come to the tap.
We would have thrown that out.
Right.
Okay. Especially with children. Okay, go ahead.
With scientific acceptability, we're looking at the specifications. We're also looking at reliability testing and validity testing, as well as risk adjustment, which is huge when it comes to outcome measures and exclusions. So for exclusions, evaluation criteria requires that evidence is presented that measures results would be distorted without a specified exclusion. And if a patient preference is a consideration in the numerator or denominator exclusions, the measure should be specified so that the effect of patient preference on the measure is transparent. And Karen, did you want to add anything about it?
Well, the reason we have you know, this extra side on exclusions is exclusions has been a growing issue at NQF, and there's some measures that we get where there seems to be a tendency to try to identify every potential exception that somebody may have seen in their practice over the last 10 years, and so we need to include it as an exclusion. And so the work on the evaluation criteria really stressed that, you know, exclusions should be limited, they should be evidence-based, there should be a good rationale for it, rather than trying to think of every possible thing that could happen in a particular situation.
I try to think of examples. In pediatric immunizations, for example, if parents refuse an immunization,
well, the discussion about patient preference, and this came up specifically in an immunization project that we had a year or so ago, and that if patient preference is going to be one of those issues, that it really should be transparent. So in our immunization project, how that came out is the committee actually recommending standard specifications, is that that would be a numerator category. So the numerator actually included patients that were offered the immunization and refused, patients that actually received the immunization, and patients.
Would be part of the numerator, rather.
Right, exactly. And there, you know, patient preference is one of those things that, and there was a lot of sentiment on that particular committee that easy to kind of check that box or lead in that direction. So they just want it to be transparent. So if it's really an issue for a particular patient.
And it also frequently can make feasibility much more complex if you start putting a bunch of exclusions in. And so I think
right.
That's another reason that I'm sure you're thinking about exclusions. The more you put in, the more difficult it
right.
is
the more data
to
you
operationalize
have to
that measure.
Exactly.
Okay, when looking at our usability criteria, is this measure meaningful? Can it be used for public reporting and quality improvement, not solely one or the other? And then feasibility, can this be done without undue burden?
And of course, you define undue burden by saying,
Actually, one of the things that's particularly timely on this is the adaptability or the ability to use HIT in this, in terms of feasibility, either using electronic data systems or what is your plan to, you know, embrace or transition to EHR use and data from readily available electronic sources. And that really is a major focus, because the idea of you know, paper chart review is pretty much no one's ever going to do it. So we need to move on.
And actually, you know, the emphasis on importance to measure and report also has some reasoning behind it related to feasibility. I mean, there's only so much resources to go into data collection and reporting, and so the idea is to really try to focus on those things that are going to have the biggest impact on overall improvement in healthcare and health. And so it's not just, is it important to do in your everyday practice? I mean, there's thousands of things that people have to do. So we're really trying to focus in on resources used for data collection, data reporting, to those that are going to make the biggest difference.
Barbara, just one thing Donald was saying. We have folks on the phone, and the question is, who's there and can you hear us? So I heard a couple of folks. Francois, are you on the phone? Can you hear me?
Yes, I am.
And you can hear me?
Yes, I can.
Thank you. Is anybody else on the line? Not admitting it. Or can't hear me. But
well, Francois, can you introduce yourself, please? This is Barbara Yon. Everybody else has introduced themselves. We'd appreciate a short introduction. you have your part of your name anyway, who you represent, and a sentence or two about your background.
So I'm Grant Arnabrant. I'm the CEO of Bridges Excellence and Prometheus Payments, and we're here today to present a couple of measures on complications of care. And, you know, my background is I've been working on payment reform and incentives for quite some time, starting with a few years at GE as leader for healthcare initiatives, and more recently on a full-time basis in this small not-for-profit organization. I've worked with ENQF before, in particular as a member of the steering committee on efficiency and episodes of care. And, you know, that's about it.
That's great. Thank you very much. Go ahead. Alexis, do you have more?
No.
Okay.
I think at this point, what we need to do is just allow each of, we have measures from three different major developers. And we have representatives from two. Not on the phone. Oh, okay. Well, we'll go to two of them. As an introduction to the measures that you're going to be looking at this morning, the major developers can provide you some background on, you know, how they develop them, why they develop them, what were the circumstances around it. Who do you want to have go first, Alexis?
First,
I'll
have to go first.
Hmm?
He's on the phone.
Okay.
His schedule's
all right. Why don't we let Francois continue, and he can explain, you know, the background to the measures that they've submitted to us. Francois, you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Okay. So
okay.
Can you briefly
so just
that?
A few words of background, because I know that talking on a cell phone over a conference line is not ideal at all. So about 3.5 to 4 years ago, we started this work around definitions of episodes of care for various chronic conditions, procedures, and acute medical events. And that process turned into what is now known as the Prometheus payment model. As a part of that, the charge really of the team was to look at and understand the different components of costs of care and to base episodes on what we could, and not just us, but through clinical working groups and teams of medical experts, delineate as being appropriate, typical, normal care for each one of these episodes. And as we did that, one of the charges of each one of the working groups, clinical working groups, was to identify the potentially avoidable complications of care that would occur within that disease state, procedure, acute medical events. And since then, we've turned these definitions into formal, delineated complication and care measures, which is what my colleague Amita Rizzoghi is going to present later today. And we've had an opportunity to run the definitions of these complications of care on several national and regional commercial claims databases in order to ascertain both the face validity of the methodology as well as its reproducibility in different data sets. And at each step, we've gone back to either physicians, hospitals, and communities, or the working group of members to look at and validate the outputs so that ultimately the original definitions around what constitutes these potentially avoidable complications of care were in fact illustrated by the data modeling. So while, you know, I certainly don't pretend that we've had an opportunity to thoroughly, statistically vet, validate, and analyze the robustness of the measure, I do think that we have at least gone through a series of face validity testings and field testings, if you will, of the results of measuring these definitions around complications of care and to ascertain both their prevalence within the delivery system and their underlying costs. So that's a broad brush. Of course, there's a lot of work underlying the definitions of these complication of care measures, and that really is what my colleague is going to focus on. But let me pause here and see if there are any specific questions that the technical advisory panel would like me to address.
I have a feeling those will be much more specific questions as we look at the measures. And so does anyone have any overall questions now? I don't think so. So next step, Reba?
Yeah. I think we're ready to kind of move on. Do we have anybody from San Francisco?
No.
Okay. So I guess our friends at the end of the table who are here with us, we get the first shot. What are the numbers and the measures?
19-OT1-109.
So, can I ask one question just about the sort of expectations for today as well? Because we've all been obviously working our own little silos on these measures. Now we're going to get together, and undoubtedly there'll still be questions that we have and have to maybe dig a little bit deeper. Is the expectation then sort of get as much as we can out through today and then still do conference calls back and forth to finalize? I mean, just to get a feel for, because it will be complex to nail it all down.
It will depend very much on how these conversations go.
Okay.
But one of the reasons we asked you to try and get the information to us is so that we could, you know, present like both reviewers' perspectives and discuss, you know, whether they're the same, everybody agrees, if they're different, where are the issues, how might we resolve it. At the end of the day, what we want is one of these evaluation forms for each measure reflecting the evaluation of the sub-criteria for the TAP as a whole. So the first step was two folks got to really look into each measure in deep to present, to discuss, and lead the discussion, and then we'll come up with a sort of a final version out of the TAP. Whether that's able to be totally completed today or not remains to be seen, but certainly there's plenty of time for us to do follow-up as needed.
And I think that you'll find that several of the measures are really quite similar.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look across, I think that we'll be able to, you know, sort of say, yes, what we said before applies to this one also. So I don't think it's quite as onerous as it looks like from having that many different measures. So I have to step back, and I'm sorry, I should have asked you this on the phone the other day. So how much do we ask the developers to give us before we start our review? Because we did have the materials, and so I'm just asking.
Yeah, I think it would be nice, just as we did with Francois, if they want to give a few minutes of the introduction, the background of the measures, then we will start discussing.
Okay. So you were talking about the other group who's present. That was my question.
Mm-hmm.
You're not asking, because you're from Bridges to Excellence also, you're not asking her to tell us more about it. You're asking the other group.
Right.
Thank you.
Right.
I was confused.
Right.
Would you?
I mean, just in general, that how the measure, you know, we usually ask the measure stewards or developers to give a brief introduction, but this is the committee or task meeting, and they're here to respond to questions or provide more information that you might ask.
Okay, no, I misunderstood that. I thought you were asking Bridges to Excellence to give us even more information.
No, no,
so
no.
I understand now. Could you please give us
your measures?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Thank you. I'm just going to open up with a few general remarks, and then Jereen is going to more specifically address some remarks about the measures. AACBPR is a group of about close to 3,000 multidisciplinary healthcare providers who work in the field of rehabilitation. And I just want to thank you on behalf of the association and on behalf of all of our members for reviewing these measures. They're very important to us because I'm sure you realize that the rehabilitation is not the as an upfront area in healthcare. But to us, it's very important, and we're pleased to see that our measures have gotten to this point in the process. It also, for another reason, is important to us, and that is that, actually for two reasons. The first being that last spring we got two time-limited endorsements for some cardiac measures relative to rehabilitation, and we were very pleased about that. This sort of is the bookend for us on the pulmonary side of things, and hope that we're successful here as well. And I think something else that might be of interest to you to know is that there is new legislation going into effect January 1 that makes pulmonary rehab a guaranteed benefit for Medicare subscribers, which was not the case prior to this new legislation. And so we expect quite an uptick in participation in pulmonary rehabilitation programs around the country. And it would be very nice to have some quality measures in place right from the very beginning of this increase, what we anticipate to be increase in activity for our services. So,
you submitted two outcome measures to be evaluated. The first is capacity in COPD before and after pulmonary rehabilitation. And the instrument of measurement that we propose to use in this is the six-minute walk. The six-minute walk, we can get into more detail, is it a very well-validated, very well-tested, long history of use in patients with COPD and in pulmonary rehab. The second measure is health-related quality of life outcome measure for patients with COPD who participate in pulmonary rehab. And in that, we selected a single instrument, the chronic respiratory disease questionnaire, for our description, although we have others if there's interest in us expanding that program. The rationale for these two outcomes comes out of multiple sets of guidelines that have been generated that are all evidence-based, and that of these are the two outcomes that have the strongest evidence behind them. For evaluation. Also, as part of the certification process for programs through AACDPR, these are the type of data that is collected by our certified pulmonary rehab centers that provide that information. Finally, to address usability, there is plans in developing a pulmonary rehabilitation registry that is currently being started. We've already begun work and have our cardiac rehabilitation registry ready to be up and running, and we're also now doing, as Larry mentioned, the bookend for pulmonary rehab. So neither of these instruments we consider to be tested. So we just wanted to clarify that.
Neither of the measures or the instruments?
Neither of the measures. All the instruments have both been very well tested and very well validated.
But using this as an endpoint for rehab is not been.
It's been described in the literature, but I guess that I'm uncertain as to what you call tested.
Mm-hmm.
We have, there's lots of literature to say both of these. We're able to show these improvements in both of these across multiple studies. However, in this format, it's not been tested yet.
Yeah, that's very. I know that's a very difficult thing to say, has it been tested or not, because I know this is an outcome of many of the studies which are used to give the evidence behind recommending pulmonary rehab. Mm-hmm. So
would you consider these measures to be tested?
I think that's the guidance from you all.
Yeah,
we go through the criteria and look.
I think we'll have to decide whether we think they have been. Sometimes something has been tested 40 times, it's just never been called apple pie before.
Right.
And so that's maybe what we're deciding. And other things, we don't even know what apples are. So we'll have to decide that. But thank you for being as conservative as possible in your definitions. We appreciate that. We may be less conservative or more conservative. Who knows? We'll see. All right.
Sure.
That
first one?
I think it's time.
We have two reviewers for
19. 19. Yes, we're going to start with him. Lewis, and I have his because he's out of the country, so
his evaluation was posted, and Dr. Millard.
Right, and this is for HQR.
Okay, wait a minute. Now you just...
It's health-related quality of life in COPD patients before and after pulmonary rehab.
Right. You know what's interesting is that when I look through all the current NQF and door pulmonary and respiratory stuff, this is almost putting cart before the horse, which is nothing to say because I think ACVR, our group, just got certified again by the program, so we like it. But there's no guideline that says when pulmonary rehab should be used. And in many ways, if you want to, I mean, the lead question of importance is when should pulmonary rehab be utilized? Because that's really more important in the long run in terms of health outcomes than whether or not we use 6-minute walk, hospital endurance, SGLQ, CRQ, whatever. I mean, so I would add that as an initial sort of segment. I really think the most important issue is the initiation of pulmonary rehab, because that's the that will change, alter the equation of outcomes. You've got to get, because if you don't get into pulmonary rehab, it doesn't matter what happens to either quality of life or exercise.
And unfortunately, this project is focused on the outcomes.
But I think that should be set up front, because that is the really...
Sure.
So that would be a process measure, actually.
Right.
For COPD.
Mm-hmm.
The number of people at each stage initiating pulmonary rehab, but that is a process measure,
right.
And we're now trying
to... Well,
actually,
but to reduce potential avoidable PSDs will be... Pulmonary rehab will be one of the tools.
Yes.
Yeah. As you make all of these comments, there are places for us to capture that and put that in, so we can say, this is great, but the most important thing is the selection criteria
right.
of who goes into pulmonary
right.
rehab.
And I just need to say
that. Got it.
Now, you all need to guide through the sort of format of this process is I've not used that syntax before. So we go to first.
So the importance of the measure and the report.
Yeah, the percentage of patients enrolled in pulmonary rehab who are found to increase healthfully quality of life. And I mean, that's an interesting outcome, because that requires that I think assumes that pulmonary rehab is going to increase the quality of life score in a certain percent of people, and we know that in general it does. I just don't know what the standard deviations are in terms of what percent of people actually, I mean, in our program, we use SGRQ, the average increase is 8 points, which would correlate with a 1-point CRQ score, which is what the guidelines note. But I don't know what the confidence limits are to saying, okay, we're going to specify a percent.
So you think that this measure should have a percent attack?
No, I don't. No, I think.
Okay.
I think that the, but I, in fact, it has one. It says the description is the percent.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Correct, but it doesn't say, 50%, 75%, 3%.
But we're going to base quality on what the percent of, are we setting a quality score at some point and say, well, if you don't have X percent of people, and this is not, you've not reached your goal.
So one of the things we probably need to do is we really need to kind of go through these criteria, and that will be kind of a measure construction issue. So the first question is about, this is measuring the outcome of health-related quality of life in COPD patients. So the first questions we'd like you to look at is this, you know, does this meet our criteria for importance to measure in the report?
Yeah, so the first, but I was like partial because I think my own bias I'm not sure that the CRQ has been shown to be superior to SGRQ. This SGRQ is central respiratory questionnaire, and in the pulmonary rehab world, I always understood most pulmonary rehab programs actually use St. George Respiratory Questionnaire and not CRQ.
Actually, that's not true. And the reason I say that is that the SGRQ is so difficult to score and interpret. It requires extra programming. CRQ is much more straightforward in its utilization. Actually, out in the clinical programs, most programs probably use the SF-36. And the other issue with the SGRQ is that when pulmonary rehab is being measured over a 3-month period, the SGRQ truly was originally designed by Dr. Jones to measure changes over a 4-year period, and that it's been found in other studies not to be quite as sensitive. So that's
the
problem with the SGRQ.
When it was sent home with the patients at home, as opposed to when it was at the site, and CRQ requires, it is not as, it is, they're different methodological ones, and my only point would be, I think that I would like to equalize the syntax between SGRQ and CRQ.
Okay. What percentage of your rehab programs use these two instruments, would you say? I mean, because that's an important consideration. If you've got a significant proportion of your certified program is not using the measure that you propose, they're just going to be using
I think there's two ways to look at that question. One is that if we are dealing primarily with certified programs, that requirement can be put into certification requirements and, in a sense, sort of push the issue to help increase data collection. The actual percentage of patients, of programs, rather, that use the questionnaire, I don't have that number. I would just be making it up.
But in a way, you could almost say if the goal here is the monitoring of the inflammatory rehab, that you could almost allow, if you think there's some equivalent, either or, you know, to some extent. I mean, that would be another way to swing this. So if you think it's okay, then focus on the goal.
You have to have validated measures. So if you have two equally validated, I know they are, but that's what I'm saying. If you have two equally validated measures, then you can say either or, as opposed to SF-36, which none of us would say is a validated measure for them.
But the issue here is this is a measure of outcome, meaning looking at the change in scores.
Right.
And so in order to construct this measure that you could use any validated instrument, you would first have to show that the change in scores that you would get by using any of those are similar. I mean, we're talking about measurement here, so it has to be standardized. So as soon as you start saying you can do this or you can do that, you're getting away from a standardized measure unless you can prove equivalency.
But they have both been used in the studies that show improvement,
right,
and they have been calibrated in this particular case.
So the two instruments,
you can use those two, I believe.
You can almost do a slash. You say CRQ slash SGRQ, and you're going to include.
In this particular situation, I think that's true.
And in fact, the SGRQ was the health-related quality of life instrument that was used in the National Emphysema Treatment Trial. So that's been the largest study in which there's been randomization for surgery, but in which pulmonary rehab was used.
But it also, just to back up, that's getting into the specifics of the measure. So under importance, what we want to know is, you know, is this a high impact area? Is there performance gap in terms of patients achieving health related quality of life? And, you know, the evidence that this can be impacted, you know, certainly it's an outcome measure, which is something that we're interested in. Is it relevant to this particular patient population? And hopefully, there's some things that can actually influence that. So those are your kind of first set of questions, and then we can get into the reliability and validity of the instruments.
So I think that's what we do, is let's go way back to the beginning, and can you tell us your strengths and weaknesses that you developed under this very first question of importance, please? Did you list strengths and weaknesses?
The strength is that it's both the quality of life measurements are well validated in the literature of pulmonary rehabilitation. The weakness is that the definition of pulmonary rehabilitation is not uniformly assumed.
Okay. Although there are guidelines,
there are, but we don't have any. I mean, we're assuming the guidelines. You see what I mean? In other words, we're assuming that we all agree on what pulmonary rehab is, and we haven't. But.
Okay, so it's way back to the beginning of importance of, you know, pulmonary rehab, as you said, has not been widely available, but will be more widely available, and we're not entirely sure that we have a definition that is universally accepted of what it is we're measuring of the importance. Okay.
I mean, it's, although the new guidelines are, I mean, with CMS finally deciding to, or Congress deciding to fund pulmonary rehab, that's now the new, what look it is about. Published in Afghanistan, will be
integrated. Yeah.
Oh. But that's, okay. I would just quickly add that CMS has now completed their announcement of final rules for how to, what's going to be paid for,
right,
which is going to drive program models.
Right. Okay. So you're saying that you believe this has high importance,
yes,
potentially, and that health-related quality of life is a very important outcome to patients.
Absolutely.
Okay. And is one worth assessing for improving quality of care?
Yes.
Is whether or not we improve the patient's quality of life.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is that sort of a summary then of under importance? And you said it meant partially. Were you the secondary review remark?
No, not on this one.
No,
oh,
Dr.
this is,
Lewis.
I'm sorry, Dr. Lewis.
Which is what I have on the screen is his review, and for high impact, demonstrating a high impact of healthcare for 1A, he said completely.
Okay, did he give us strengths and weaknesses?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, could we look at this?
What did he do for the other criteria? Just run through the.
Well, I mean, this is all what the staff did, so I want to see what
the submission submission.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's
reviewer.
Right.
Yeah. No, staff has an evaluation.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. You're absolutely correct. I just wanted to see what
he said. C again, completely, for opportunity for improvement, demonstrating a performance gap.
Okay.
And then evidence to support, he also has C.
Okay.
Yeah, there's
a problem. Yeah, that's what I really am interested in, this comment. Okay, so here are his comments. The strengths, regulations regarding these new requirements include provisions for number of sessions, required elements directing physician supervision, and other components. So, he's saying he believes that CMS's new criteria will help define what pulmonary rehab is at a minimum anyway. Okay. Clearly have a major impact on a large segment of the pulmonary disease population. Known therapeutic performance gaps will be impacted. Compelling high-grade evidence to support the benefits of well-designed and performed rehab programs. The weakness is likely to be a limited number of programs that could help to close this performance gap. And I'm reading this because I think it might be hard way back there in the back. Cost of implementation is really unknown at this point still, even though CMS has reimbursement plans. We all know it won't be for everyone. Logistics in terms of requirements for greater physician involvement, which is a good measure, but may deter new program development. So he has some concerns about, that's really the requirement of CMS, that's not your requirement in the measurement. It doesn't It's not a specification of the measurement.
But I guess by us saying that we concur,
yes,
that those are valuable things to have in terms of tracking pulmonary rehab, it would lend weight to that or not if we said, well, we don't care. Throw them in a program and see how they do. You know, I mean, we're sort of buffering up what CMS is saying.
So we're saying that we're accepting CMS's definition.
Yeah, on our own terms.
The problem is accepting CMS reimbursement, but
they
work. Ironically, CMS has, in a wonderful review of pulmonary rehab and the effectiveness of it two or three years ago, they said there's no question that pulmonary rehab is an effective intervention. It's just not a covered benefit. That has Congress to, and so Congress finally, when somebody was looking at it.
All right. So
no, a lot of hard work.
Yeah, I'm not a lot of hard work. So we have someone saying complete, one reviewer saying complete, one reviewer saying partial for the importance. Should we go on?
Mine is complete. My only partial had to do with the consideration of using only CRQ, the emphasis on CRQ.
Okay.
And with those sort of concerns, actually, just in terms of this process and structure, be more in the scientific, mm-hmm, in the second step.
Yeah.
So we're going to have,
yeah,
the,
yeah. So the importance is really complete, and we
agree.
We're
all in agreement.
Okay.
Although the one thing, the opportunity for improvement, the citations for data on performance gap, at least as first one, comorbidity, mortality, and COPD-related hospitalizations, there's no discussion of performance gap in that reference, and I'm not sure that there's the literature on performance gaps in pulmonary rehab. I mean, it's to be determined because it was such a sort of scattergun of people get pulmonary rehab that we have no way of knowing what the previous performance gaps were.
Well, like I thought the performance gap was really sort of between people who didn't get any and people who got some, or got not some, who got it and who didn't get it.
It was all driven by whether or not CMS reimbursing the local and the LMRP or not. So that,
well, except the randomized controlled trials were
right.
Not a rat.
But this is about patients in pulmonary rehab.
Yes.
So is there a performance gap in...
We have no way of knowing.
So this really would not be completely for this particular 1B then, because there's no data that was provided, right? Are you aware of any data that there's variability in achievement of...
We do not know yet. I agree.
That's why.
Because nobody did a randomized control of halfway done pulmonary rehab. Oh, a little hard to do that. Okay.
I think from your viewpoint, the performance gap is all in one.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. For all
incompletions.
Yes.
Yes. Is that what this is measuring?
Right.
Because this is measuring those in it.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's not that question.
Right. Yes. So that is the question. Should this measure of improved health-related quality of life be restricted to those getting into pulmonary rehab, or should it be for all pulmonary patients? I'm just asking. It's not
ideal. Not all pulmonary patients. COPD patients of a certain stage. Is who should be the comparator group is what I think people
right,
are asking. Do we compare people only in pulmonary rehab and say this is a good pulmonary rehab program because 90% of their patients achieve this improvement in quality of life versus this pulmonary rehab program where only 30% do, or is it this is a 90% improvement when they don't get anything, 3% improvement.
Right.
And so that's the question,
right,
is can this become a broader measure than actually what you've said? Could it include patients in pulmonary rehab to say something about the different kinds of pulmonary rehab and something about not getting it at all. But that's not what you proposed.
I would say that sounds like a different measure.
Yeah.
Maybe a desirable one, but a different
one. But a different one. So that might be a gap for the future.
Well, because you guys have already sort of bought into the concept that pulmonary rehab is a value for these people, and then it's a matter of tracking how well the program works in terms of outcomes. So if you bought Part A, then you wouldn't be looking at it in Part B. So you would have to restructure the whole treatment.
Well, it is sort of interesting because what you're talking about right now, basically referral too, I mean, that's the denominator. It's all that the population out there. And then the numerator becomes those people who get referred and participate. That's exactly where we went with the cardiac side of things. Referrals from inpatient hospital programs as well as outpatient physician offices. And there's, as you can imagine, there are quite a few pitfalls around trying to get that denominator. With cardiac, there's that acute event usually.
Okay, so let's...
Pulmonary, there is.
All right, but let's take a step back. And now we're saying, is this measure important to look at for people who at least are referred or begin pulmonary rehab? As that is the only group we're now discussing. Is this an important measure?
Again, on the burden.
That's fine.
I don't think you're...
In a rehab program.
Yeah, that you're in it. If you're referred to that,
That's fine. I'm sorry. People who are in pulmonary rehab, is this a valuable measure for everyone in pulmonary rehab? Does this meet the complete importance?
Yes, but there are these citations do not really support that there is a performance gap. There's been very little work.
Right.
So there's really no information about performance gap.
There's limited information.
So we believe this will provide a lot of potentially useful information, but we can't be sure. Okay. So that's why you might have said partial instead of complete, because we truly believe, but we don't have a lot of evidence out there. Okay. Let's go on next to the second measure, which is...
The second section.
That's what I meant. The scientific part. I'm sorry, we're having trouble with words today. I'm having trouble with words today. So the scientific
part is, again, now the numerator and denominator is the first.
Right.
Is that the first issue?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
the specifications, which is quite long, but yes.
And I think that my concern primarily was CRQ versus SCI, that we needed to broaden that to include both CRQ and I'm much more familiar with SCRQ than CRQ, but we were a NET trial rehab center, so we did lots of SCRQs and had to decide what to do and chose actually the SCRQ over the CRQs because it was, my staff said, easier. So
your staff would be among some of the few, I believe. From a primary care perspective, we would never choose
SCRQ.
No.
But it sort of factors into that sort of feasibility issue.
But this one,
standards,
you
can
expand this numerator to say 1 point on the CRQ or, I thought it was 5 on the SCRQ, but you're saying it's...
Well, 0.5 on the CRQ is the minimum clinical difference.
Right.
And I would... in terms of the numerator, I would like to see that I define a positive improvement as 0.5, not as 1, simply because I'd like to define it as the minimum.
Well, can we change? We can't really change measures that way. We have to accept what they're suggesting when we rate it. I mean, you can't change somebody's measure in the middle.
I think that there's certainly room for discussion around that, but this should relate to what is the evidence that it should be one or the other. So,
wouldn't we be in our ultimate recommendation saying this is what we don't accept it like this, but would we like this? I mean, would that be basically providing the feedback and then they kind of know what path they're on?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you're suggesting that you would like to see it rather than saying 1.0, say the determined clinically minimal difference. Because that doesn't have that isn't then specific to any one of them. There's either of the two are validated measures.
I'm not sure if this is the right point for this question, but how easy is it going to be to collect data?
I think we need to wait for this feasibility stage, if you wouldn't mind. Okay.
And the numerator is just the number participated in PR and trying to increase healthcare quality of life score by the minimum significant clinical difference at being in the PR.
Well, it says the time period should be no more than 3 months.
Right.
And we know that those scales are can measure change over 3 months. So we're okay with that. All right.
Do you remember details that have to do with just the CRQ?
Which can be expanded to add the SGRQ for the same way. Okay.
Denominator statement, all patients with COPD during the reporting period who are enrolled in a PR program. And so again, I think that's enrolled, not referred to, which is different from what you've done in cardiac rehab.
Yes.
And I agree. Now, the next target population range, and this also relates to harmonization later on down the road, is persons greater than 20 years of age. And this is a this pops up several different parts on both, on all the COPD processes. Most guidelines talk about 40 and above or above 40. And this is 20. There's another one that's greater than 18, I think, on the PAC reduction. So there needs to be a uniform age target, target population range harmonization.
Well, and it needs to be clinically relevant. I think if we started telling most physicians we're going to look at COPD pulmonary rehab at age 20, they probably think we might have lost our minds.
I mean, I guess you could have different age cutoffs or with different allowances for chronic diseases that are in young adults. Is what, you
well,
know,
but that's going to be risk adjustment, I think.
What was the rationale for such a low, such a low entry age was to be able to include those patients who had very early onset without the one antitrypsin. I appreciate it's 1% probably of the population.
Oh, but having early onset COPD
right.
is even less than 1%.
I tell you clinically that I've had patients who were 26 years old.
Oh, of course.
In my rehab program.
I understand that, but aren't they kind of the exception?
Yes, they're the zebra. Yes.
And I, you know, obviously as a primary care physician, I'm looking for horses.
Have these instruments been tested in alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency?
I believe they. I don't have the literature in front of me.
I think for the purpose, the greater purpose of harmonization, I'd say 40.
Okay.
That would be my recommendation. And you'll capture 95.
You'll be much more than 95, I suspect.
And what is the process for allowing for case-by-case exception? I mean, I know you brought up the whole exception issue, but, you know, if this were an adopted guideline and then recognizing that there would be some legitimate fallout, you know, sort of misses where we're setting the bar is going to miss some people that would legitimately, that just kind of too bad, or can you
remember
kind of
that this is not, you're not, these are measures of performance of the facility. You're not talking about taking care of every single patient.
No.
So if indeed it's the exception, how will that really impact the overall assessment of quality of care provided by that facility if they're not included?
Right. I guess you sort of feel the weight of any sort of guideline recommendation because you know how easily they get adopted as gospel. Right, you know, which then can exclude people that you really wouldn't care to exclude because you wouldn't mind if they were in the mix. But I don't know where
and,
we are.
And these really are not guidelines. They're measures. So we're not, you know, the guidelines are developed by the clinical specialty group. So
that isn't one of the strategic goals that these become, you know, essentially looked to as.
Well, they're what we call consensus standards for measuring quality.
Right, right.
So
But, I mean, do you have any reason, let's turn it around the other way, do you have any reason to believe that if we only measure 40 and above, this will negatively impact the quality provided to people 20 to 4 to 39?
If people really consider these just measures and sort of recommendations, no. I think the risk is how things get applied.
Yeah, but I don't think that we can, again, go out for all exceptions in the world and say, I mean, Medicare is not covering the patients 20 to 39 already, and so...
So what I guess, then maybe put your question another way, what is the risk of including the broadest population?
I think there is a big risk of including the 20 to 39. They are quite different than people aged 40 or 60 and over, and I think that if you had a large number of them, which some sites might, they could adversely affect your outcome.
For the site.
For the site. That's what I'm concerned about. But there may be so few that they'll never be a statistical even blip on anybody's radar. So. It is face validity, too, though. For most physicians, they look at that at 20 and they say, what are you thinking? Mm-hmm. And nurses and everybody else. I'm not picking
I think we said 40 and we're consistent with other... Mm-hmm.
It also becomes quite difficult sometimes to tell asthma from COPD and somebody who's 20 years... Yeah, and have severe asthma.
Okay, so now the denominator details. One of the questions I have is PR program entering completion. We've completed at least 10 PR sessions within a 3-month period, 90-day period. Is that CMS language? Is that what their definition? What do they define?
No, it's not. It's not CMS.
What do they use as the minimum? Because I really think we need to be consistent parallel with
what does the evidence show that a pulmonary rehab and is that how the CMS?
I'm not sure how that 10 came out within 3 months.
I believe the 10 came out of the interim rule related to lung volume reduction surgery. That they had a specific number of sessions that were required prior to lung volume reduction surgery to be able to indicate some kind of change. That certainly could be modified to the current CMS language.
These were written
before
the rules were published. I guess I have a question about this in a little bit. Suppose you have a program that nobody ever completes more than 3 because your program is just impossible to get to. It's not interesting. It's not anything. I don't understand why you have to have completed the 10 sessions because I think adherence is the biggest problem we have across all of healthcare, and this ignores the adherence issue entirely. So my take would be, and I know this changes, but it changes the specification, anybody who starts and attends one session is in.
But you may not get post-program data.
Yeah.
Well, but you
can.
Well, but you can say that you have that many. You have no. A lot of these people will, on the telephone, give you that, and I think, you know, you should at least try to follow up with everybody who starts.
So we think there'd be a minimum set though that you'd need to have the exposure to then see a benefit in these health-related quality measures. So, you know, the question. I mean, would you actually envision that one session would then change your CRQ or
absolutely not.
Right.
I would not anticipate it, but
right.
It says to the program, there's a problem here. Because you have so many people dropping out that you don't get this improvement. So again, it's measuring the quality of the program, not quality of completion of the program. That's the difference. And which one do we want? I mean, we can say we're looking for the quality of the program if you complete the program.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, from primary care, it's always if you start the program.
Yeah, no, that's fair. So
I'm just asking.
It should reflect the whole program, which would include your ability to hang on to people, follow them up. I mean, the whole meal deal. I mean, that, I think, is what you're getting at. Rather than just say, we only going to look at you if you finish the whole shoot match.
Because you're narrowing and narrowing and narrowing what you're measuring.
Yeah,
because the rate of completion is not anywhere close to 100%.
Absolutely not. But I would just respectfully suggest that that's probably a program outcome in terms of how your adherence is as opposed to a quality of life outcome.
Right.
That's patient-centered.
A different measure is what you're saying.
I believe it is, yeah.
But maybe a desirable one.
I'm
going to respectfully disagree. I think that is a patient quality of life outcome measure. If they start the program, they don't complete it, their quality of life is not improved one iota, or maybe it's improved greatly. I don't know. I do still think it's a patient outcome measure, because if we start ignoring adherence, when we talk about outcome measures, I'm really concerned about we're going to be measuring the outcome in this tiny little group of people. But this is a group, and I'm going to be willing to listen to everybody. And don't let me drive it. I'm just asking difficult questions.
You almost have like two different denominators. Which just makes it two plus. One is people who complete the program, one is people who enter but don't complete it. Because the data will, in our experience, we enroll about 10 patients in clinical rehab every 6 weeks. It's a 6-week program, and they've had 10 come in. And we'll lose routinely 2 or 3 of them.
Yeah. I expect you to lose 30% minimum.
And usually the reasons are either they get sick or life happens. So that would significantly impact the data if you didn't have a, and one of the reasons to put down the minimum clinical significance as opposed to
a higher
one is to allow that. But I think we can, these are not fixed in stone, and I think if you say the denominator of people enter the pulmonary rehab program, you built in the drive to adherence. And if in retrospective review you find that this is just that denominator is too big, a denominator, then that can always be modified.
And you build into that that language probably into this measure even now, where that you're actually trying to look at the overall program's effectiveness, but then also the specific health care, like quality of life among the completers. Because it is a different question. Both are true, but
that it affects, it goes back to my level of importance. If it is only measuring completers, I think it is a less important measure than if it measures all beginners.
So you would take out the entire 10 sessions in 3 months. You would say?
No, it's fine to have both. That's fine. I'm just saying the measure as proposed, and that's what we have to keep looking at, is the measure as proposed. This to me then says there's a gap in this measure, and that we can talk about gaps later.
Because I think what you're suggesting is, regardless of program, if people complete, they're probably going to have this improvement in health.
Well, no, it's just that if you don't complete the program, you have very little chance of having any benefit from the program.
Right, right. But will there be any variability across programs?
Yes, there will.
For the completers? If you only measure the completers,
yes, there will, I believe. Don't know that.
Completers will have a much higher quality of life if you measure those.
I think Karen asked, if you look at people who complete in Dallas versus people who complete in Seattle or Rochester or New York.
Well, but the ones that complete in Podunk, Louisiana, Podunk, Minnesota, we'll say. I'll pick on Minnesota. May have different rates of improvement in quality of life than the ones improved in Rochester. It may be higher.
Yeah, that was my question.
Yes. So, okay. So we've said that you think this is acceptable, but the gap is that we are not doing anything about non-completers. We are not looking at adherence in this measure.
And under strength and weakness, that will be a weakness.
Okay, thank you. The first one always takes a long time, and I apologize because we have to think through all of these things in context. So, okay, just Do you have other strengths or weaknesses under, we're going to go on with the denominator.
Can I just ask, the pulmonary rehab program, does that need to be defined? Or is that, is that going to be defined as defined by the CMS regs? Or is there other definitions? Or how do you know it's a function? I mean, I just don't know. Is that kind of a...
I would say this follows the guidelines of the joint, ATS, ACCP, AARC, ASCVPR, everybody's on board with
the guidelines. There are guidelines.
So it probably should at least just reference what that definition is or...
Okay.
Stratification. A word on the board. Stratification details. Don't have any. I mean,
right.
Stratification, risk adjustment. All these things are fairly. I think we've discussed them. I think.
And you're comfortable with the no risk adjustment? I mean, we have to have said. We have to mention that because it's going to get a lot of pushback.
If there's no risk adjustment.
Yes, and it's okay. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying.
I can't see a risk adjustment.
Somebody who has cardiovascular disease or very severe arthritis who has more trouble participating and gaining some of the functional improvement might not have as big an improvement in quality of life. And those are quite common, or people who are depressed. And I'm not saying we have to do it. I just know that we're going to get pushback from other people. So it's okay to say we just are taking all comers.
It's a very big issue that outcome measures in general should be risk adjusted, or a very good rationale for why not. So, you know, I mean, if there's evidence that patients' achievement in this area varies by comorbidities, severity of their COPD, then what's the justification for saying you don't risk adjust? So I'm just, those would be the general questions that will come up as this measure continues through. So,
and is the justification that people, we're still talking about a difference in quality of life and improvement, so people who have all of those comorbidities start quite low and they go up the 0.5. People who don't have all those comorbidities start much higher but go up 0.5.
And the other issue is that including both the SGRQ and the CRQ, these again are disease-specific questionnaires. So they're going to focus primarily on the pulmonary symptoms. And that's what we're using to calculate a score. So they're not going to focus so much on the symptoms that we would see as part of the comorbidity.
Well, that's not true for cardiovascular disease.
Well,
dyspnea is dyspnea is dyspnea.
Right.
You know, and, you know, so you do have that issue. But, and almost all of these people have cardiovascular disease, because they were long-term smokers. So.
It may come up more with the non-completer issue.
Yeah. Well, the other issue where it really will come up with risk adjustment is when we do Richard's, which is a physical metric as opposed to an emotional.
Yeah, the six-minute walk. So we're saying that we do not believe we have to risk adjust because we're using a disease-specific outcome measure, and because we're using the individual patient's change in score, which already accounts for their difference in initial scores. So that's our justification for not risk adjusting? Okay.
Welcome to Verizon Wireless. The wireless customer you called is not available at this time. Please try your call again later. Announcement 1-1-1-9-5.
Be there anymore.
Or anyone else.
Yes,
welcome to Verizon Wireless. The wireless customer you called is not available at this time. Please try your call again later. Announcement 1-1-1-9-5.
Please. Thank you. Okay.
The only thing that may kind of be seen as a conflict there is if we're saying the reason we don't need the risk adjust is because we're using individual changes, but then we're saying the weakness of this current measure is that we're not capturing the quitters, so to speak, you know, or the people that can't finish the program. Well, that sort of rationale for the non-risk adjusting wouldn't work for the people that come and just stop, right? Because then that's going to affect the whole program scoring.
so to speak, if you have people that have that arthritis, come once, can't walk, stop, you're not, if you don't risk the death for them, would you recognize that they had a higher likelihood of not completing?
Yes, so right now the measure as proposed is only for the completers. So when we talk about the gap, and talk about the gap is that you need to measure non-completers, then there may be a different comment on risk adjustment for that measure. But that's a different measure than this one.
Oh, okay. I thought we were going to sort of encourage or propose it to be together.
Mm-hmm. No? I don't think we can, I mean, we can say they didn't do that, and we think it's a gap.
Okay.
I mean,
the ten sessions is the key. That's the denominator is the 10 sessions.
Then the delta's fine and there's no risk adjustment.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's, I think, where we are at the moment.
I have to close my brain to what we just said about the other thing.
Well,
in a way, assessing the risk adjustment is only based on what they wrote, not what we're saying is a problem with it, and we would actually buy it.
One of the things you're doing is both evaluating this and trying to make a better measure at the same time. You're welcome to do all that, and we'll capture it as, gee, it would be nice if, but the actual evaluation is what we've got here.
How many of you sit on study section? Have you ever been on a study section? Okay. Yeah, in study section, we say, this is the proposal. You can only evaluate the proposal. You cannot rewrite it. At the end, we will, by saying, the gap analysis, gee, we don't have a measure that measures the quitters, and we'd like to have a quitters measure, and we won't call
it
that.
Well, and also in the weaknesses that you identify in this measure. So.
Yeah.
So we're,
all right.
We're now passing analysis reliability testing.
Yeah.
I said P simply because I wanted to balance out CRT and SRT.
Okay. Otherwise, you would have said
yes,
C.
Otherwise, it would be C.
Okay. And is that the last thing?
Lending testing.
Yeah, there's more here.
Content validity has been reported. And again, comments of ditto, which would be P just because of the
SGRQ. Okay.
And I want to make sure that they also, and the earlier caveat about what the, and Reed, I don't know if this enters into what you had to say earlier, that you want to suggest something different that's on the side or the study section about this is as it is, because this proposal has a 1.0 score, and I think we all agreed that it really should be the minimum clinical differential.
Well, I would ask you to examine that, because number one, why was one chosen? And right, and that's what I'm saying. I'd like to hear a little bit more around that discussion, because it sounds like this measure, being a measure, has established a certain threshold to, you know, to achieve the you know, positive credit, if you will, and you're differing with that, but I haven't had a handle exactly on why that is.
I think we selected the moderate change. We certainly can go with the 0.5. There would be no argument on making that modification whatsoever.
But what's the argument?
It's all out of the same article. It's all out of the JC article.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did, though, was that we were looking for that whole point difference. We just went with the moderate change because we expect to see a larger change than that, actually, because we're looking at completers.
Right, and the evidence behind recommending pulmonary rehab was first based on it had to achieve at least the minimal significant difference for it to be recommended as valuable. But then it wasn't a huge decline in the percent of people that received moderate versus the minimally significant difference, so that what you said was you chose the one because you didn't think it was that much different in all the evidence from the number of people that achieved 0.5.
Right. Yeah. So that's a modification that would easily be made.
I guess we'll really need to grapple with the intent of the measure. If you're basically trying to say we want to identify the really good programs because they're able to achieve a higher change
score, and that is a reflective of the quality of the program provided, then, you know, that one may be your choice.
Food.
Yeah, I know. Well,
I mean,
that's what I'm trying to find out.
Thing is, I don't think there's any data that,
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at is, yeah, is there
a data? Really
that
have
right.
a problem. What we're really going to have a problem with, and we need to look forward, is that when we look at the physical measures,
home
rehab programs don't even meet the, when you look at 6-minute walk,
yeah.
they don't even meet
Yeah, but that's
a minimal clinical difference.
It seems to me right now the question is, are we trying to identify good programs or the really good programs, or are we just trying to understand the variability across the country, which we don't even know that yet. We don't know the
and
variability.
Is there a clinical difference? Because that at least sets a goal for everybody to try to achieve, and then you have to look back and see if you reach that goal.
And then you have that binary concept, like either yes or no, and that could get you a pool of programs, but then you'd still be tracking the amount of interval change, so that then you could grade the programs if you wanted to against each other by who had small, medium, and large changes.
Well,
I mean,
that's only if the measure is constructed
to do
like an average instead of the percent that she achieved this minimal.
Right.
You could have the mean change, but that's a different measure, and it's not going to happen unless it's actually
specified in all kinds of things. So right now, are we willing to accept the 1.0 instead of the minimally significant clinical difference from the data that has been presented saying that in the studies there was not a lot of difference between the percent that achieved 0.0 or 0.5 and 1.0 because I can't remember, it was 2-3% difference is all in the number of programs, and so that's why you chose a higher standard. Is that putting words in your mouth?
That sounds right on. Okay. It was coming out of trying to figure out the highest level of quality, and so perhaps we looked at this in the wrong way. We should have looked at this as looking at quality in a starting point rather than a higher level.
Well, but even 1.0 seemed to be a reasonable starting point from what the research data is.
But again, I defer that. I think it would be appropriate, being the one that wrote this measure, I'm almost embarrassed to admit right now, I think the 0.5 really is the better one to go with. But I appreciate your reviewing what was on paper when it came in.
So what do we do about
it? I mean, I think it's a negotiable point, but I think ultimately this speaks to the question of the tools that have been used have been tested and validated. But the measure as specified, I think, is where you're all having your questions about. And it sounds like we don't have enough data of how that will, you know, perform when it's put in place to evaluate the quality of various programs. So the question then I would ask you, we go back to, has the measure been tested or not?
Not 1.0.
Well, not across lots of different programs. We don't have data using this across lots of programs, but the measure has not been tested. So what do we do about
that? So you don't have any data on this measure. So you haven't done any kind of program scores using this measure. You don't have data.
We don't have that data.
Oh.
We're just starting our registry.
Oh, then it isn't.
Yeah, well, the question I would ask, though, of Dr. Millard is the research data using 0.5 essentially a test of this, where you got results of comparing programs, or, you know, that you could see how the measure performed at the 0.5 level? Is that what the research data shows? Because that potentially tested that measure, that version of it, if you will.
Well, then the programs measure improvements and the goal is to see improvement.
Right.
And what's improvement? 0.5 or above.
Mm-hmm. So the net, it was 0.5. Right?
Well, but that's the minimum clinical difference.
Right,
that's we can say, yeah, we did something.
So in a big trial, that minimally clinically significant difference was used to then establish benefit.
But it was not used to compare the sites. Did the
right.
did the it was aggregate data. It did not compare different sites. It was,
yeah,
you know, it was a study proving that this tool, this intervention, thank you, this intervention is beneficial, but it did not measure the quality of the sites. It did not differentiate amongst sites. It was aggregate data and pooled data. So I don't believe they presented. I mean, we could probably go get it, and then they may not give it to us, actually, because they may have promised not to give it to anybody.
Although, is this measure actually saying this has to be able to compare sites, or is it just saying this is what we're going to use to identify significant difference? And whether you say it in one program or multiple, they're not actually speaking to comparing it.
That's the reason for NQF endorsement, is public reporting and quality improvement. So public reporting implies that someone could look at a variety of program scores and make some conclusion about which one has the better quality. It's part of the mission of NQF endorsed measures.
And it's just that this has never been used to do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The comparison can be done in a couple of ways. You can have absolute numbers, percentages. The other question, I think it's a more focused measure, maybe less robust, but to ask the question, what percentage of patients do hit the minimum? Perhaps that is useful information or not. I don't know.
I
so it'd be yes, you did versus no, you didn't.
It's more useful than what percentage of one, because we don't know what the difference between 0.5 and 1 is. We know what 0.5 is. We know that 0.5 is a minimum clinical.
Well, isn't that what this measure is? The percent who
gets
1.0 or greater? I mean,
right.
That's what this is.
I think it should be 0.5.
No, I hear what you're saying.
But, yeah, you're right. It is a percentage.
Right. And that goes back to the question. It is untested measure.
I'm trying to find a way around it.
I think we've all tried several times. That isn't bad, because COPD rehab is so early that we can understand. It's so early in its history, unfortunately, for widespread use. We understand why it's not yet tested. That doesn't mean we can waive all the requirements. Mm-hmm.
And I'm just kind of quickly going through this, but do you have that information about the minimally clinically significant difference? Is that mentioned in the information you provided in the submission form?
That is the JCR.
The what?
I don't know.
You didn't extract that information. It's just in one of the articles. I'm just asking if you...
You need to go back to the validation for the two measures now that we're talking about, and you have to go way back to those. I don't think you quoted those as references, is what I was saying.
Well, actually, the JCR article from 1989 is one of the earliest on the CRQ, and that was reliability and validity testing. For the SCRQ, that's very simple. I have all of that.
Yes. So you did give us a reference.
Uh-huh.
You just didn't say that.
Which one?
Right there. Yeah. Okay. Clinically important difference.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we have it. She just didn't.
Right.
It is.
Right.
Yeah. Because they use a higher standard.
Right. Yeah. It's something, it will be, whenever a measure is based on some kind of benchmark, we can almost predict the question will be, what's the evidence for establishing that benchmark?
Well, and we have it.
Right.
We just could pull it out in a specific sentence. Okay.
Exclusions justified.
Let's go down. Can you take us down to the exclusions, please?
And that's... You know, requirements, psychiatric conditions, she can't read or write,
or speak.
Or speak, yes.
The language. Okay.
And then it says risk adjustment for outcome measures resources. It says not actually.
I think, you know, just as we've already talked about, it's not that it's not applicable. It's always applicable.
Yeah.
It's whether there's a justification for not doing it.
Well, and in our comments, we can put the justification we already mentioned.
Right.
Okay. In identification of meaningful differences in performance, this is where I think we'll have significant. My recommendations would be, in the sense of as written, 1.0 change or moderate, and 1.5 represent a large change. I think that.
And this is a little confusing in this context, but what we're really looking at here is difference in performance across programs. Because the measure is measuring a program. So, again, it goes back to the question we talked about earlier. Are all the programs going to end up with 90% of their patients achieving this? Or
we don't know, but I think all of our expert guesses are no. That there will be a fairly wide variability, but that's
right.
I guess we'll call ourselves expert opinion. Okay.
And 2G, comparability of multiple data source methods. Unfortunately, you probably asked the wrong person since I'm on this here. Therefore, I'm going to just say, you know, this is M on that as well. But
can you really, really, in your heart, justify saying CRQ is not good?
No, I just can't say CRQ is the, quote, most reliable validity and feasibility of use in patients with CRQ programs.
You could say one of the two most.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then disparities in care, talked about is this disparity of related to how many people, is it a completed program or not, if that's what we were.
Right. This is really intended to go back to the first question about variability and opportunities for improvement and whether care and outcomes varies by what are typically considered disparities, you know, by ethnicity, race, socioeconomic status, sometimes gender. So if they've identified that, you know, gender is an issue in people getting correct care or achieving outcomes,
the
can,
one
can it be measured?
Well, they suggested we could stratify by gender, so if we did that, we'd be able to tell by gender.
Right.
The other one, you may have mentioned in terms of the weaknesses, but one of the big areas of disparity for pulmonary rehab is geographic location. And there is no discussion here because if you live 50 miles mm-hmm. from the program, you start the program, it goes maybe more to the ones who are unable to complete, but does that lower your ability to improve your quality of life because you have to drive 100 miles every time you go? I would put geographic disparity under there as a weakness that they didn't look at it, but not a deal killer for certain. Okay, so these are the strengths and weaknesses that our colleagues who are with us today, because he's traveling internationally. English only, we have that. We said that was a weakness that we could only do English at this time. Oh, the IPS patient? You don't have ITF patients in here, do you?
No, this is specific to
COPD.
That's what I wondered, because I'm thinking, well, yeah, okay.
Mm.
Okay, and he's just saying the other weakness is he doesn't think that CRQ deals with emotional things like depression so that you aren't measuring a full scope of quality of life. Does the SGRQ do that, do you think?
It does have some depression, anxiety.
With its 400 questions, it ought to have some.
Have the symptoms, activity, and impact subscores at the limited total score.
So,
okay.
So, I'm not sure where you're at with the recommendation that this measure should include both tools. Is that something you've decided on yet or made a recommendation about? Or is that a weakness of this measure as it's stated?
Well, I think that we have one person saying he believes it is because of a number of the programs currently use that. And it would require those programs to change what they do from a perfectly acceptable measure of health-related quality of life to another measure of health-related quality of life, which you don't know. I mean, that's a burden. I was going to put it more under burden and feasibility than I was here because I, you know.
Okay. I'm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And the good news is they do cross-talk so that.
Yeah.
Yes. Sorry. The Minnesotans understand apples. Okay.
But what if you're saying one includes depression and the other doesn't, that bring questions in my mind then, are they equivalent?
They measure different things.
Actually, the CRQ does have a subscore of emotional function.
Yes.
So I would respectfully disagree with the reviewer's comment on that.
And I agree with your comment. I think that I just wanted to read what it said. I don't think one ignores depression and anxiety and the other brings it out. Okay. Shall we go on then?
So do we know what they've agreed on for the...
Okay, I'm sorry. What's the rating for this?
Completely for all of them.
Yeah, and what are you... For the measure, as stated, we know your concerns about the SGRQ, but we're going to try to deal with those more under feasibility. If you didn't have the SGRQ concern...
Complete.
Would it be complete?
Yes.
Okay.
Except for the performance gap, or
that was under important.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And also the testing,
and then reliability and validity.
Right. So this part.
Yeah, this is untested. So
I think it would be P because this issue of what level were they putting at 1.0.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we say P.
Yes.
For
the scientific. Okay.
Yeah, we have to do each of the subcriteria.
Yeah.
You're saying all of them put as P.
Well.
2F you had is minimal and 2G.
Could I suggest that
we go back and we'll fill it in?
That we fill it in later.
Okay. Complete.
And then we'll give it to you guys.
Yes. Because I think that, and I'm going to suggest things happen in general, to do all of those subs is going to slow the discussion down a lot.
Mm-hmm.
If we can do the 4-day category, that would be very helpful.
Well, we
can't. No, I know. I mean, we go through them and we look at them and we take notes. But then we don't go back and say, can we do each one? We try to do it from the notes.
Okay.
Would that be acceptable to try?
We can try it.
If it doesn't work.
So what number are we at? 3.0, meaningful, understandable, and useful information.
Yeah.
And I thought it was extensive with intended audiences, can understand the results in meaningful, likely to find them useful for decision making. And with the caveats above as to sort of what would be the appropriate benchmark, I think it's complete.
Okay. And he thought it was complete.
Okay.
So.
3B, 3C, relation to other NQF endorsed measures.
No.
That was not applicable because there weren't any.
And again, there is this thing about 4 years and over. There needs to be harmonization.
Thank you.
3C, distinctive or added value, and I would say complete.
Well, since there are no existing measures, yeah. It has to either be not applicable or complete. One of the two.
That's easy.
Yep.
Strength and weakness, I think.
So you're pretty comfortable with the C for overall,
yes.
For this one?
Yes. Yes.
For 3?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, in terms of feasibility, how the elements, one of the big issues is going to be in terms of data generation is, 4, and this is 4A and 4B, I think, for both are, how are these going to be redactable in the HR?
I think it's the overarching issue. How can you retrieve the data? I mean, it's a yes, no. Is the patient in a pulmonary rehab program? How do you even ask challenges? The new regs are going to put you ahead of the wave, that wave, so that's great. Because we couldn't do this last year or 2 years ago. We had no way to retrieve who was even in a pulmonary rehab program. That solution looks like it's going to get solved, but Mark and I talked about this earlier. Since you're looking at differences in scores, how can you do that? And that's the hard part.
So this would require all of them to do it baseline and do it...
But somebody's got to go in and extract the data. It can't be electronically retrievable.
Why?
Because these are going to be scanned documents that you're not going to be able to say, tell me what the first one was, tell me what the second one was, the computer difference.
You're assuming that people will not have that ability in their pulmonary rehab program.
No, we have an electronic health record, and these sorts of data get scanned. And so we couldn't do this. And I suspect that since most people have electronic health records, some of ours, they're going to have the same problem.
They have to pull it out separately and change it and enter it just that you could retrieve it automatically later. That's changed the current clinical process, have it be automated.
Right, you have to change the EHR for pulmonary rehab program to make these electronically entered.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is true for pretty much any of these things.
It's not an issue specific to this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is general. Right.
That
yeah.
For anything yeah. That's going to require a number other than a yes no binary situation, which is a difficult problem.
Well, anything that doesn't have a specific ICD-9 administrative code right now is not easy. Some of lab test results you can now pull out electronically. But
so is this typically done in a paper pencil format to the patient, and then who in your office would go through and score it so that you get the score? And is that score entered?
It's in the chart. There's a in our chart, our pulmonary rehab chart, I see the first SGRQ, I see the SGRQ at the beginning, I see the SGRQ at the end, I see the 6-minute walk at the beginning, I see the 6-minute walk at the end. And it's scanned into the electronic health record.
Right. But doesn't someone have to go through those answers?
Oh, yeah.
Come up with a score?
Usually
yeah.
The person that administers
yeah,
the score. But that's easy.
But that data is not retrievable.
So the score, but the score, if...
It exists in the chart.
Okay.
So if you did a chart review, electronic chart review, like you do paper, you can go down and scan through, find the SGR, or the CRQ, either one, and say, okay, there it is, and there it is, but you have to go in. It's not like administrative data that I can tell you how many people have an ER visit in the last year.
So, about all data elements being available electronically, that's a no, not a
yes.
Yeah, but it's right.
If everything you say regarding Mark's measure applies to the 6-minute walk,
yeah.
So we're doing double.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and with susceptibility to inaccuracies, errors, and things are the same kinds of problems you have anytime you have to have somebody score something by hand.
Now, the ideal, obviously, would be to chart each one over time, because if we take a look at laboratory test results, CDC or whatever, we actually have, and that's electronically retrievable.
Right.
And CrutchWorks, which is the system we use, we don't have that functionality for things like this.
So you have to specifically go in and program a template for it, and that's, you know, that is a barrier.
You see, able to electronically know that they've had it done.
Yes.
So that they've had it at the beginning and the end. You could just
say, no, but that doesn't help a lot.
So say your electronic record had a flow sheet, you know, like you use blood pressure or whatever. Can you have a spot where you could be recording the overall score?
Unless your program, somebody would have to have it programmed in an interval on each visit.
Yeah.
That's not impossible.
Right.
Currently, it's not.
Right, right, right.
I mean, I bet this is not going to be different.
Oh, yeah.
For pretty much
it's something we encounter at every
administrative
right.
data.
Right.
So.
Maybe you should, since we're in the first step, you should just take this discussion and
right.
save time with the future ones and say, no, we've done this already.
Well, but some of them are based on administrative data only,
yes.
and those will be different.
Right.
So, you know, it's one of those things that we would love to have all pulmonary rehab programs have an EHR that facilitated this.
But they don't. Okay.
So, let's go.
Now, the other question was whether or not that data was available. Accreditation? If that data is going to be available, are you going to publish the improvements in CRQ or whatever SCRQ is just going to walk on the programs? My program? Yeah, my program? Is that going to have, is that data going to be retrieved?
To the best of my knowledge, and both Sheree and I are on the board of directors, I don't believe that question has been answered yet.
So
I think it's been part of the discussions.
So that we have a potential source to consider, but that would be only for accredited programs.
That's correct.
And so that would introduce tremendous bias and limit the scope.
And then, by the way, just I don't know if this is helpful or not, hopefully it is, but the company that we are using to develop this registry, electronic registry, will be having fields that will be able, data fields that will be able to report scores that it's a custom database, so whatever we ask for is what ideally we get, and that may get at some of the questions that you've just been struggling with.
Yeah, but again, it's not available currently, it's a wish for the future, and we don't know even if it is there, if we'll be able to have access, or if the reporting
is
in
development. I mean, that much is true. We're under contract for them. It's going to happen.
I want to just ask a question back on your submission about use of public reporting initiative, and you put NA, does that mean not applicable or not available? Under 3A, use of public reporting.
I have decent public reporting initiative.
Uh-huh.
What I have is the CRQ has been used as a measure of...
No, right above that, you have NA.
NA. Well, if the measure's never been tested...
Right, but I what I'm getting at is just the measures are supposed to be intended. You see, use in public reporting initiative, you have NA underneath that.
I'm not working from the final copy because I
don't
have access to that. I'm working from our final draft that was on the submission forms. I don't have
Well, but it's right here. What she's saying is it's right here.
Right.
It says, use in public, I know you can't read it from back there, use in public reporting initiative, and you put not, or NA. And is that because you don't think it should be, that it hasn't been? What does that mean?
Well, this measure hasn't been used for public reporting, so it's
not it's never been used for anything.
Right. It's not available.
So not available. It's not that it's not applicable.
All right. I did not enter this directly myself. We had our executive director and our information to NQF. So
the only reason I'm asking is the public reporting intention for public reporting is a big issue at NQF, and the board recently affirmed that NQF endorsed measures should be publicly reported. So if you were thinking that this type of measure should not have any public reporting.
I can see the opportunity here for misinterpretation of the question there.
Right.
Yeah. Has it been used in public reporting initiative versus could it be used?
Yeah.
It's
not just going to be could it be.
Will it be?
Will it be? And we are changing the question.
Yeah.
This is
something
that's been evolving. But I just wanted to get there.
I can just tell you what we thought when we did that. Since you asked to provide the name of initiatives and locations URL, I view that as a task-looking question. Forward.
Right, and that is changing. But that's the only reason I was asking if she meant not applicable or not available. Or
so it could be used, and did you develop it thinking it should be used for public reporting? This measure?
Yes.
Okay, so you have the answer. It just never has been.
Correct, yeah.
So it was not available, not that it wasn't applicable.
Right.
Thank you. Okay. So where are we with this one now? D? Or 5, I'm sorry. Feasibility, thank you. We are feasibility.
Right, and we said initially how the data analysis that are needed to compute scores generated, and I think that, I mean, see there, but the electronic sources is where we fall down.
And also, this is where we were going to talk about programs that currently use the St. George having to change to this one. If it's specified exactly this way, it could be a problem. And so we think that it would be easier for the programs already using St. George, which is equally acceptable and valid measure. It should, they should be able to continue doing what they're doing.
Let me ask a couple of just general questions since you were the developers of the measure. If you take a look at a broad spectrum, what proportion of patients with COPD across the country actually have the opportunity to be enrolled in one of the pulmonary rehab programs? What percentage of COPD patients actually get into a rehab program?
15-25%. It's
so
very,
very
small.
So it's low. Yes. And are there rehab programs across the country that are certified by your organization as well? How many of those are there compared to certified programs?
We're still attempting to collect that data.
So you don't have any certified programs, you just aren't sure how many uncertified programs are.
It's a fluid number. That denominator is so fluid that it can be calculated, but it's good for that day.
Mm-hmm. The programs open and close according to the budget from the last month, pretty much.
In Minnesota, over the last year, it's gone from less than 50% to about 65 or 70% certified now.
Permanent.
Yes. But when they start, CMS starts paying for it, I'm going to bet there's going to be a whole lot of uncertified programs.
And so 15-25% of patients with COPD currently enrolled in some sort of pulmonary rehab program, and you envision that going up in January because of the new regs.
And I think we would also expect to see that there will be an increase in number of programs, because now that there will be a way for funding, even though
that's
funding
what he's
great.
Because I think that at the board level, they're going to want to know the commonality of this. If you've got 10% of patients in a program, the measure is of limited value. If it's going to be 50-70% of patients, it has
Well, and I think the new guidelines are, this is not right now reasonable, but the new guidelines are going to move it up to a higher level of COPD patients with higher FEV1s as appropriate.
But going from 60 to 70 is actually probably not going to make much difference, because the average mean onset of unless we're making the diagnosis a lot earlier.
Well, but we're working very hard on that part, too. So over the next 5 years, this could increase remarkably, is what we ought to say, perhaps. Very good question. Thank you. Okay. Are we done with this measure? Do we feel like we have a sense of how we will move it on then to the steering committee?
Just, I wanted to bring up, we have someone entered the room who joined us and hasn't been introduced, so perhaps you could just tell us who you are. And
hi, I'm Adam Sedley. I'm a very prepared doctor.
Okay, thank you. All right, well, we're considerably behind schedule, as you might have noticed. But that's okay. We're going to take a short, can we just do a 5-minute break instead of 15, please? The restrooms are down the hall over there.
On either side of the elevators.
Okay.
Can you do like a summary there, like, you know, just 4 out of 5 stars or, yeah, any, like, some sense of, to give the heart of the
Well, I think that's what we're going to have to do when we listen and we pull it all together is send you a summary.
Yeah. Kind of seems like you want some sense of, are we more on this end of the spectrum or that?
But the current thinking is that we have to give the steering committee information about each of the sub-criteria and not make an overall recommendation. So,
but just what we'll want to do is summarize.
I'm going to go in knowing what the overall feeling is. And if they seem to be reading it very differently than we think we wrote it, I will be able to say, wait a minute, I don't think that's what
we
want.
But that's why the identification of the ratings for those sub-criteria and the strengths and weaknesses are important. That's what the steering committee will then use that information.
What we'll do is from all this and draft up what we think we heard from you and
We're all right here.
I know, I can. My computer. Your finger can.
But that's why I taxed my admin assistant several pages yesterday.
Anita's here, so we want to be sure that we have the lead to start something up.
Good, that's what I'm saying.
We do one and then they're all
set up. The issue I would like to do is like when I first put it in, so I lost all the material that I copied. If you put it on your desktop, I can put my flash drive in your computer and just copy that. Or do you want me to use your flash drive for a second?
Yeah, you can copy it on there.
We'd like to see where we're going.
Yeah, it's fine. You can do one of these.
That would be
the children one we can do.
I can take your phone.
I wonder though, like the computer gave me some message about like not having enough memory.
We are working hard though to say they are not pediatric patients. They are children. We'll see.
Well, this one also will have an interesting thing as well. The thing is, it's a real question of the child health during the morning, it's one of those weird ones.
Yeah, they can, but I hope the child health is not going to get into specific disease control.
What is there?
Because if they do, they're going to be there for the next 6-minute
walk.
That's one thing about child health work.
I worked on some of the child health measures about
how come they
have to get into the outcome.
Well, but then you have to,
Yeah,
Well, we need to get the other people back in the summit. We have everybody pretty much except Karen.
Yeah, that's fine.
She can move with us. Okay, she can catch up with us.
Yeah.
Okay, the next measure we're going to go to is already up there.
So this is measure 20.
Right, this and is it's functional capacity. This is comparable. It's the same group presented.
So there will be the same problem.
Okay, there will be many of the same issues. Okay.
And our reviewers are Dr. O'Connell and Dr. Millard.
Okay.
How many of the comments we made for the last one apply to this one? I'm going to lean heavily on Dr. Millard, who was some of these things, as I indicated, on the pediatric app. So while I understand measurement, pretty much the pulmonary rehab issues. In terms of importance to measure and report, they'll look like large numbers, absolutely. There's no doubt about that. I would agree that with number one, as you see. One B, opportunity for improvements. Summary of data demonstrating a performance gap. I believe all of the comments we made before is line. We all suspect there is a performance gap. It varies by geographic regions, but there's little data at the present time to be able to point to that issue.
So but they must be really good because they quoted me.
I did know
you
that.
Are very smart. You checked that, didn't you? Uh-huh. Go on. That is not a measure of performance, Ralph. I have to tell you. It's only opinion paper. So.
And so I scored that a P on this particular issue because I think that there is, while we believe there isn't data to support it quite yet.
So expert opinion is high, but expert only gets us P.
Exactly.
Okay.
The one C outcome of, or evidence to support the measure of focus, I'm going to have to defer to Dr. Millard. I did note here that in the Goldstein paper, they quote outcomes including a 38-meter increase in systemic block, and yet the measure suggests a 54-meter measurement cutoff for improvement. And I wasn't quite sure why the change was made from 38 meters to 54 meters.
We're having a lot of trouble following. We don't have any numbers in light.
Okay, right here it says that, you know, the evidence, you summarized the evidence that 38 meters increase in 6-minute walks from this article from the
randomized controlled trial.
Right.
And
you have other articles that say 54
is Rettelmeyer.
Better measure. So
Rettelmeyer is the one that's most consistently
okay.
cited.
Well, but that's minimum clinical significance.
Okay.
That's not outcomes of pulmonary rehab programs, and that's how the discussion comes back and haunts us because previously in the HQL, whatever HRQLS, we used the minimal level of significance as the benchmark. Unfortunately, the vast, when you look at mean data on pulmonary rehab program improvements in 6-minute walk, which points out the problem with 6-minute walk, is almost all of the programs reported improvements below the minimum clinical significance.
Which is 38 meters.
Which is 54 meters.
But what article does that come from? The 54 comes from Rettelmeyer. The 38 comes from Goldstein.
Anyway, one of the issues I struggle with here in this 1C is that I couldn't find evidence for why the 54 meter distance was being recommended when the only quote was the 38 meter distance as a similar improvement outcome.
Right.
So, okay. So I gave that a P myself. So. Okay, next one, we go to 2A, precisely specify the number of patients.
Well, wait a minute, so your overall weaknesses, are there any other overall weaknesses or strengths that you wanted to comment on one? Do you think you've covered them all in your comments so far?
Yes.
Dr. Maher, do you have any other?
Well, I mean, the weakness is that the benchmark, what if it's 54, that current published data on pulmonary rehab programs do not meet minimum level of clinical significance, and it's not likely that they ever will.
So you believe, you know, we would assume that only 30% or less, perhaps, of people will ever be able to reach this benchmark.
What I don't know is the percent. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I'm guessing. I was making a guess. So that you believe if you set it this high, that it will always be less than 50%. We can say that at least, probably. We don't know what the median is, but we'll assume the mean and median are similar.
The other question is, if you look at a frequency distribution curve for pulmonary rehab units, do you have some rehab centers that are consistently showing superior results in this compared to those who don't? It sounds like none of them met the 54-meter requirement. Is that what you said, Mom?
I would say one of the best ones are at UCSC. And if they're not meeting it, nobody's meeting it.
Well, they aren't meeting it as an average.
Yeah.
And we don't know what the percentage of patients in
the frequency distribution. That's right. I mean, there is probably a better metric that is more sensitive to improvements in pulmonary rehab, as it turns out, which is the constant endurance time. But
so again, we have an untested measure, but the literature suggests that the studied rehab programs cannot meet this as a mean improvement.
So how did 54 get established as the clinically significant improvement?
Well, that's totally separate from how you would decide how much you can do.
Well, it's a six-minute walk distance is used in a lot of other disease entities.
Right, right. So you're saying that 54 is not specific to COPD?
I think it is.
Oh, okay.
It is.
Okay,
it's
all right.
COPD.
Yeah.
Well, what they said was, if you can't improve by 54 meters, then it doesn't improve your life outside of this. So they looked at things like your ability to shop, your ability to do activities of daily living and things like that. And if you couldn't do a 54 improvement, you didn't improve those other things.
Okay.
That's how they validated the minimal clinically significant difference.
Right, good, okay.
So,
but, well, I think that's a huge question of whether it should even move on to number two, because if you're saying that's a benchmark that is not relevant, then the question is, should we even care about how it's measured, because what's the purpose?
Well, and we don't have, because we don't have the frequency distribution, we really don't even have a good idea. 10% of the patients meet it, 30%, 20%. We know it's less than 50 for sure, probably. So what do you think? Is this a measure that we should go forward and do all of the rest of the assessment on?
Because the importance deals with high impact area, which I think you've all agreed. Is there an opportunity for improvement, which basically you're saying we have no idea. And then the third area is the evidence, and I'm hearing that there's a lot of evidence that this isn't even attainable. So
I just believe
Okay. I'm sorry.
No.
All we're asking the TAP to do is point out these things. It'll ultimately be the steering committee that makes
so
that
decision. So we really have to go to even though we think.
I'm sure it would say as it is written.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So importance should go to what then? What level of importance do you want to say? C, T, M, or N?
Well, it's not an overall. That's for the steering committee. So what we're asking the TAP to do is to tell us whether high impact, which I think you're saying is C, opportunity for improvement, I think you're saying P or M. Because
actually, I'm going to go back to the fact for the overall impact because we aren't measuring the people who drop out are going to a P. Would that be acceptable for the rest of you to say importance is P?
For the high impact P.
For the high impact is P.
High impact P.
Okay, then I'm sorry, go ahead, go down please to 1B so we can get that number. Opportunity for improvement, what are we saying it is? We don't know.
I had recorded that as a P because we don't have any data.
But are you willing to go P or do you want to go lower because of the concern that so far the program can't meet that, we don't think?
Well,
but the 64 and the 38 do know there's something.
Let me explain, too, what the scores mean. N means not at all, not addressed, incorrectly addressed, or not demonstrated to meet the criteria. So if you think based on your judgment that, so having no information would actually be an N, but if you think that from your judgment that there is some evidence or...
Well, there's some evidence, but the evidence suggests that it didn't meet that criteria, so that would still push it back to N, wouldn't it?
It's like the concept of setting the 6-minute walk is more solid than the goal measurement. If it hadn't really kind of had that high of a reach, we'd probably be saying this is all very doable.
Well, like we said 34 or 30 or something,
right.
But then we say it's not clinically significantly different, then we have that problem.
Right.
So either way, we have a big problem.
So, is there any evidence either demonstrated, I mean, we don't have it here, opportunity for improvement, the performance gap, we don't know, is basically what I'm hearing you say. And the evidence for the 54 is also, under 1C, is also...
I'm not sure what you're saying. Although the ATS article that Mark has, read that second point.
Well, the clinical relevance of the benefit of formulary rehab is illustrated by the improved functional capacity as measured by the 6-minute walk test. The pooled effect size of all randomized controlled studies as a result of formulary rehab is 49 meters with a 95% confidence of 26 to 72. The minimum clinical importance difference in the 6-minute walk test has been estimated to be 54 meters. And that reference is, to answer the question of where did that come from?
Rettelmeyer, 1997.
Is that 43? Rettelmeyer, 1997. Got it.
So, where do we want to go with this?
Well, the question is, has it met the criteria? To what level? Completely, partially, minimally, or not at all?
Okay, we're going to make you say something.
Well, the 54-meter, are you looking at me?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The 54-meter is an estimate of minimally clinically significant difference. I'm not sure what data that's based upon because it's an estimate, where in the actual study, the average was 49 meters.
Yeah, but that's totally different.
I know. And so what percentage of patients actually achieve 54 meters or greater? Anybody have any a clue? Because that's the important question. If it's
whether it's achievable or not. And that there are data to support it.
Exactly.
So right now we have no data to support it. So doesn't it have to be an N?
I think given the definition that she described it as, yes.
Okay. Anybody want to make it something else? I mean, please realize that this doesn't mean that they can't go back and change the measure and submit it again. We're not telling them to go away forever. We may just be saying, right now, this one doesn't work the way it is.
Because there is a disconnect, 37 meters, 49 meters, 54 meters.
Yeah. So we don't know what's what.
Exactly.
I think just the way it was written, because the earlier one really should have been written as quality of life should be measured, health rate quality of life should be measured from a rehab program as an outcome, rather than say this is a benchmark for distinguishing between success and failure. Likewise, you should say there should be physical assessment measurements in home rehab, 6-minute walk.
But that's not really an outcome. That's
a process measure.
And so they were required to do outcomes.
If you look at the in measurement, I mean, diabetes is the best example that Mark and I were discussing earlier. 15 years ago, we were happy to measure what proportion of patients actually had an A1C measured.
Right.
And then we went to what proportion are well controlled, adequately controlled, and we're now at superbly controlled. And now we bundle them. There are 5 measures. And you're either excellent or not. I mean, so we've seen this shift. And so starting with COPD as a process measure doesn't bother me very much because we have to start somewhere.
Well, but that's not what our group is
all about.
But I think that's part of the context that we will give back to the steering committee is that it is very early in its expansion to being a major intervention.
And being ahead of the curve is a good thing.
Yeah. They give them time to come back when we're ready.
So what is the forum for these valuable process measures? I mean, without getting too far off topic, it does feel, I mean, I understand the need to be constrained, but also you hate to think you're being constrained just by external constraints, and there are good ideas out there that are just getting caught up.
Well, they have, there are other times that process measures are called for, and actually, if you go through all of the process measures of NQF, they do have process measures, lots of them.
Yeah, I just mean for contemporaneously.
And a suggestion, just a suggestion for a better outcome measurement that at least if you read the literature on the remark would be a constant low endurance time. Because that has been shown to be much more sensitive to changes in pulmonary rehab than system.
Well, and is it then directly related to the patient's life?
It is as well.
Yes, that's what you get.
I come at it from a burden standpoint.
Okay,
we were at 2A then?
Yes, we are.
Is it precisely specified? Sure. COPD, NPR, who have achieved at least 54 meters, it is very precisely.
Okay.
So I can give that a C.
So that one's a C.
Let's see.
2B?
Reliability test.
It doesn't mean we like all of it.
Yes, no,
it just means that it is.
Yes. According to the, looking at what they provided, the developers have provided, it would be, it seems to be a reliable measure that is.
Yep.
It had a correlation of 0.88.
That's pretty high ICT.
Yeah.
So, okay, so
that would get
to C.
And 2C, validity testing. I did it. C here was based on a study of 60 patients. That's an incredibly small number of patients to hang your hat on. I will defer to my pulmonary colleagues on this. I don't know if this really.
Well, then they were also patients with end-stage lung disease.
Why are you testing the validity of the use of 54?
I don't know. Tell us what.
It's just a physiologic. that six-minute walk, the backflow to compulsion. That's it.
So this doesn't do what you were talking about earlier about connecting that to quality of life or function and...
No. So, T or M? I don't think it can be a C. With 60 end-stage lung patients only and not talking about what it meant for the rest of their life. And the fact that we use pulmonary rehab in patients with other than end-stage lung disease. So what would you like it to be?
I would give it a T.
All right. Yeah. T sounds great.
And exclusion is justified, I think, everything we talked about before. Twice here. So I gave that a C.
Yeah, the only exclusion that they do have, and they don't say explicitly, is the people who don't complete all get thrown out, and we've talked about that, so. Okay.
QE, risk adjustment, I suggest that's not applicable for this discussion. 2F, identification of meaningful differences.
And it's not applicable, but it is applicable,
yes.
But the same things we said before apply this time, too.
Yes.
Okay. As above,
below. Yeah, better way to put it. 2F, identification of meaningful difference in performances. Yeah. 12 patients with stable, severe COPD, half of whom were women, mean increase is correlated with patient perception of clinic and increases. The Erlenmeyer data, they're determined to be 54 meters. Again, it's 112 patients, and so it's not a huge number of patients. And so, and they don't, I don't get a sense of what percent of patients actually accomplished 54 meters. And so I gave that a P.
Right. And again, this doesn't address the overall of these things. They're still at the instrument level versus the overall
measure.
Level. Right.
Okay. So P. All right.
The comparability of multiple data sources and methods.
This is really, what this is getting at is, which doesn't apply to this so much, but say you have a measure where you say you've got these specifications if you do a chart abstraction,
right.
And you have these other specifications if you take it from claims data. And the question is, will you get comparable scores? But it's not really
claims.
Applicable. In
right, case. Because you would write down how far they walked, no matter where you get it from. So we can say not applicable, and you'll accept that.
I think so.
Okay, disparities in care?
One disparity they talk about is that fewer than half of the COPD patients have been diagnosed. But that's not really relevant because we're only measuring programs. People enrolled in a PR program anyway. I'm not sure disparities in care is applicable. I gave it an NA.
Is there any question about equal access to pulmonary rehab programs that might help along these kind of lines?
But if this is a measure of people who have access already, then that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So if you already have access, you know, are women and men and high and low income people or different ethnicities likely to have different outcomes because of those issues? And
well, the disparity of care, ironically, at least in our area, because our local CMS, Meteor has always approved pulmonary rehab, so we've always had it. But ironically, private insurance would not.
Yeah, so there was a disparity, but it was backwards. And it was before this measure would be applicable that the disparity should be seen, which is a weakness of this measure. We've already talked about that. Okay.
Three, usability. Is it meaningful, understandable, and useful? A six-minute walk is a six-minute walk. So in that perspective, yes. It's very understandable. And it's useful information. I think it's currently employed by all pulmonary rehab programs. And so I gave it a C.
Do you think it's understandable to the average public?
You walk for 6 minutes and you can't, how far do you go?
I just wanted to make sure because you had only commented on health professionals. You can walk farther if you go to this program, and that must be good.
Actually, the harmonization, I don't think that's an issue. It doesn't apply here. I scored this. There are no other recommendations currently to pre-harmonization issues. 3C, distinctive or additive value.
Since there aren't any majors otherwise?
Exactly. I do that. I'm not
sounds good.
And feasibility, everything we talked about before for next year, because of electronic health, the challenges that we faced. It's the same issue that we talked about.
So what did we give it? We didn't give the other one actually anything because of all of the, do we give them P? What do we do
on the feasibility?
Yeah.
Yeah, because they admit here coding and extraction are performed by someone other than the person obtaining the original information. I mean, if one of the goals is to move to using measures that only can be retrievable electronically, then it feels that,
Well, but if they have their registry, and potential, I mean, they have suggested solutions, so that was why I was...
Yes, I think that you could probably score it as an M with an explanation there.
I have no problem with that.
As I said earlier, the measure is written currently.
Right. Okay. So is there any more? Usability? Go ahead, usability.
We did it.
Oh, we did it. Oops, I'm sorry.
Those are the three.
Yeah.
Well, those were the three. I'll get this down in a minute. One is important, two is science, three is use, and four is feasibility. I'm getting there. Okay. Thank you. That was very good, very thorough, I think.
Dr. Millard was the canary you sent into the mine, so...
The only question I have about feasibility is when it says extents of which required data are readily available, retrievable, okay, without undue burden, and then can be implemented for performance measure. Now, we've already cited that performance measurement, if this is a performance measurement, the majority of programs, what we find, don't work. I mean, it doesn't, you don't hit the performance measure.
Well, but isn't that where we said, well, you could put it again here, too.
I mean, that's part of feasibility, and I think that's...
Okay. Mm-hmm. So that would take feasibility down to, what would you like it to take it to, M? Or do you want an N?
If it's time zero, it will be N.
Okay, let's do N then. I have no problem with that specific statement. This is why it moved from M to N.
But you're saying your statement is because the majority of programs cannot meet that 54-meter goal.
Because the mean programs don't meet that.
Yeah. Well, and these are not the mean programs. These are the programs who are in randomized controlled trials, so tightly controlled, nobody can do what they can do. So this is efficacy, it moves to effectiveness, we know it drops by 50%.
8 out of 14 programs reported in the literature did not meet.
Yeah. So, okay. All right.
Okay, the next one is 023, intensive care unit length of stay.
Okay, we've got a change in groups, and so you didn't get to give us any information before. Were you here when they gave their explanation?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what we want is short explanation of where did this measure come from, and why do you have it, and on what basis? Is that a close enough
sentence? Intro.
Yeah.
Okay.
Please.
So
did you introduce yourself to me before, either?
I did not speak again. I'm Adam Sedley from UCSF, and I'm a pulmonary and critical care doctor. I spend most of my time developing measures of performance. And
no wonder we don't have any pulmonologists anymore. You guys are all doing... Would you go back to doing pulmonology, please? Go right ahead. Sorry.
No problem. I founded and run the CHARGE Project program, which produces CalHospitalCompare.org. And as part of what we do there, we have 246 hospitals in California. We measure ICU performance. However, ICU performance measures are not new not new when CHART started. In fact, we needed risk-adjusted ICU mortality measures and other ICU outcome measures for decades, and they have been around for decades. So the first versions of the models that I'm proposing to you today actually came out in the 1980s.
All right.
When we started measuring performance in California, our program was voluntary. We had to get the hospitals together to get them to agree with other stakeholders what should be measured and that it could be measured adequately. I, at that time, well, for now, was on the Joint Commission's Intensive Care Unit Performance Assessment Committee. And the Joint Commission was getting that measure set ready, and we adopted something. We adopted it, basically, what it was at that point. We, since then, have added the risk-adjusted length of stay measure. And we today are presenting from that group of measures only the outcomes measures. So it was the risk-adjusted mortality and risk-adjusted length of stay. The model that we've been using in California is the mortality prediction model. We've now gone up to the third version. That was based on work that we did where we first compared all extant models of Apache, SAS, and TM, and found that for the purposes of assessing hospital performance, it didn't terribly much matter which model you used. You got the same ratings and rankings for hospitals regardless of model. But we also address the issue of how much time and effort it took to obtain the data, and the model that we use, the NPM model, requires about less than a third of the time required to collect the Apache data, and about half the time required to collect SAPS. I think I'll probably, so now it is up, it is publicly reported. We have 246 hospitals that volunteered to do this with us. Not all of them, but almost 200 of them have, a little fewer, over 200 have ICUs, and they are doing this on 400 patients per year.
And they're all in California still?
They're all in California.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, there's nothing wrong with California.
We need you in the legislature.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with California assessing its quality of care. How's that? That's what I really meant. I am not going anywhere near their politics, so I'm sure you don't want to either. All right, very good. And I'm going to assume a wild guess that you might have been a reviewer on this one.
I was.
Even the primary, huh?
I was.
How about that? And the secondary?
Is Dr. Lewis and his.
Okay. Great, thank you.
And then we're flipped for the other one.
All right.
Yeah. So, and I think some of the actually input that you have may answer a few of the questions that we're going through, which will be good. And I think just summarizing, and correct me if I'm saying this wrong, but I think the nice thing about this is it's sort of using ICU like to say, in a way, it's kind of a surrogate as well for ICU resource use, quality of care, efficiency of care. I mean, that's really kind of what we're getting at the heart of it. And this is presenting a modification of a model, as you described, that's already out there and is modified for contemporary kind of mortality assessment and as relevant to really the ICU environment, not just hospital mortality. And then using the other sort of attachment is the ICU outcomes data collection instrument, which they provided as well, which is what would be the data collection piece. And I don't know if that was already out there for the prior, or if this was developed just for this piece, for the round three modified.
Is an evolution from, okay. So when we built it, the first time it was with MPM2, which we got from the original, and then this is a modification.
Including the data collection instrument.
I don't know if you guys ever consider or talk about two at the same time, but this and the next measure come from that same form.
The last measure is sort of overlapped, and the others that we're going to talk about overlap greatly. So sometimes we'll spend a lot of time on the first one, and the second we say, as above. Okay, and so this one is the length of stay.
This is the length of stay. And the reason we are hearing kind of the mortality talk is more because that's the prediction model that was used kind of really to help them
risk stratified for the ICU. So, but this is all about the ICU length of stay and the mortality is to come.
Okay, and my first question is length of stay and outcome?
It is.
Okay.
No, I'm just asking.
No. Well, no, I actually had to think about it for a second.
Yeah, it's not one that is maybe as readily understandable to the, you know, unlike a 6-minute walk, which, you know, people can understand, but, you know, if you do kind of describe it to how long you're in the hospital or they do.
It's kind of a proxy for, like you said, complications, management, et cetera.
So but I think we have to be able to justify that to the steering committee because I can see several of them saying, wait a minute, that's a process measure.
Right.
So we're saying it is a proxy measure for how well the patients do.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, at least as I was kind of running through the list and thinking about it kind of in a more rigorous way, it's about kind of resource use, so it's kind of a cost-related issue, but then it's about quality of care, efficiency of care, I mean, all those things that then combined end up in one sum sort of outcome, which would be your length of stay. So all those things
together.
Your
viewpoint is that it is an outcome measure.
Yes.
And the other is that it's better not to be in the ICU than to be in the ICU from the patient perspective. Well, I mean, I think that's perfectly justifiable. Well, I know, but you want to be well enough to not
get
be
out
in the ICU.
And when you're there, you want to get out.
Yes, you do. Okay,
out and alive.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure we could justify that to the steering committee.
I think as we kind of start ticking through the issues in terms of whether it's for 1A, whether it's important and is really describing sort of a high impact area. I think they did a nice job of actually sort of accounting for certainly the cost perspective. I mean, I think, again, it's a surrogate in some ways of quality and effectiveness and all these other things, but really not only number of people affected, but, you know, high percentage of total hospital costs. However you slice this, it ends up being high impact, whether it's number of people, cost, social toll, you know, all those sorts of things. So I think that, for me, is out of key.
Okay.
Which is a good thing. I kind of like A's, but we don't have A's on this. This whole thing I'm having on my whole brain is going to have to get reworked. Okay. And then B, sort of the opportunity for improvement. There has been established certainly variation in ICU length of stay, certainly within regions across the country. So the ability to sort of document that and then allow some public reporting and tracking that you could actually benchmark yourself against other equivalent hospitals, whether it's all academic centers, community centers. I think there'd be a lot of ability nationally to be able to do that. So I thought that was on target.
And there is national data, not just California-based data.
There is national data.
Thank you.
Yeah. About variation in ICU, like to say?
Yeah.
Better describing.
But we didn't want to have to compare all of us against California.
No, we'd like to be able to do a whole range. And then the part C, outcome or evidence to support a measure focus. I think here, sort of the ability and sort of saying that this outcome sort of, we're kind of getting back to think of the same question whether it's an outcome or not. I think the ability to invoke efficiency and quality and then compare between sites, I think, made it a relevant measure and focus. And I'm just seeing, I actually put it as a key and I'm just trying to remember why I did. Sorry. I think actually, because at that point I was sort of thinking about it more as a summation as opposed to a single sort of getting at this issue as an outcome or a sum of things that ends up being an outcome. So it kind of slid a little bit off of C to D to me, but it really is getting at the same measure that we were talking about.
So you're pretty comfortable with it as C?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And then I don't know how we compiled here with...
You have a C all day. He's a C guy.
Yeah, I know. Like how you score, how you do evaluation.
But we do want to make sure we talk about the strengths and weaknesses a little bit because those are important.
Yeah.
So, he's got the same comments that you made about there's good evidence that it varies. And yes, this is important. The weaknesses, not, they're confounders, okay. Yeah, I had this last question to E, the step-down beds. I work in a smaller hospital. We don't have step-down beds. Our patients have to stay in the ICU until they're ready to go out to the floor. How does that affect this measure?
Yeah, I kind of had the same issue that sort of threads its way through all of this is how are we describing an ICU, how your hospital is set up, that infrastructure impacts a great deal, whether it's step-down bed availability, boarding because you're too full to get people out of ICU, you can't get people in the ED up, and how to actually, you know, is this a, it's valid as long as everybody has similar issues or in tracking over time, but is that a chunk of this that there's a way to assess, or is this measure hurt by the lack of that?
I think so it's within your hospital, tracking over time probably is okay because it may not change too much.
Right.
Comparing my hospital to yours, and I don't know if risk adjustment is going to deal with that issue or not. But
I think it's always that hard. It's a hard one to actually quantify, even within a hospital, which is probably why it you know, kind of fit in there terribly well in terms of measures. You could describe hospitals and somehow try to build it into a model about whether you had multiple levels of care as opposed to just two levels of care. I don't know if this is something you guys have struggled with.
Well, so we have a community sample of hospitals, so we have every type
range
of hospital. A lot of people think California is all urban, but actually,
we have
our populations in rural areas. There are issues of what, you know, how you draw the lines around the walls of the ICU. But in general, the view of the participating hospitals has been that and this includes even the small one, Barbara, if there is a good reason for the patient to be somewhere else, then you can, it's actually not that hard to create some step-downness. If there are issues of the ER blocking things and making, you know, ICU patients end up sort of being admitted to the ICU but actually physically in the ER or something like that, then those are flow issues that ought to be worked out in the hospital. And so they haven't objected to this being a performance measure for either the entering direction or the leaving direction because they feel like if there's a problem there, it's a legit thing that they ought to fix, both because the patients, you know, it, so if you could create step-downness, then you're taking the less sick patients away from the more sick patients and you're reducing the risk of passage of infections, et cetera, et cetera. And ER blockage is a problem not just for calculating your ICU length of stay, but actually for the care of the patient. So they have, in general, accepted this.
So the underlying assumption is ICU care is bad, is the longer in the ICU, the worse you are, and the underlying stuff. So if I have tally pulse oximetry beds that I can move a bunch of patients in the ICU out to, and that will lower my length of stay right away, that's good. The assumption is that that's good.
Clinically, it's better for the patient.
Okay. So but that's the underlying assumption is however you get them out of the ICU.
On the back end, and also on the front end, however you get them in. So this business of calling them an ICU patient, but having them sit in the ER for 24 hours is not as good care.
But do you have evidence to say that it's better to get them out when you don't? I mean, we really don't have the ability to hire more staff to have staff down units. It just is an economic. So can you show, do you have evidence that it's better to get them out of the ICU and put them in a non-monitored bed?
So no one's done randomized trials of taking people and putting them in different situations. The longer you are in the ICU, or taking patients at different points of time and of equal status, the longer you're in the ICU, the more likely you are to get infections, other iatrogenic complications. I think that there are... I guess what I was trying to say is that on the whole, while there are some measurement issues related to moving the length of stay, related to moving the patient from the ER, and also to moving them out, the hospital community has not raised that as a significant issue in terms of feeling bad about my ICU length of stay being measured this way, and that's in a community that's very large, includes all types of youth, because on the whole, they also feel like they agree with the intent of this measure. Shorten this and things will be better. And if my problem is in the ER, then I want to work on that.
Okay, well,
it's probably, I mean, it may come, for me at least, it tends to keep bubbling out. It's probably my own little internal world where it just, it feels like that Smith test for the, but my world is so different because I have a stepdad or I don't, or I'm boarding or this. So maybe that Smith test that feels off if it's not included, although your experience with the variety of hospitals would actually speak against that because it doesn't seem to be wigging them out about that. But it may come up actually probably less relevant for the integrity or the high impact of the value, which I think is probably pretty solid, and it may come up a little more that we might be able to just outline that as an issue, whether it ends up being a real...
For usability, for, it may be an issue.
Or in the specification, or the science.
Yeah,
science.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think I think we're solid here.
All right.
So see the problem.
Could you make a comment, even though I'm not a major developer, just from the science point of view? I had worked with Dr. Michael Pine and associates in this Cleveland Health Quality Choice Project and also the Anthem to Prostitution, and it was more for cardiovascular, so it wasn't pulmonary. But what we were doing was we were doing ICU length of stay or even hospital length of stay as an adverse outcome measure. And we would do risk adjustment for patient issues, but then for the hospital-based efficiency issues, we would do control charts. So like what you would think, Barbara, is within a hospital, you could look over time and see. So that's the efficiency piece. And you can't compare one hospital versus the other because they have their own problems. So the control chart would help us parse out whether it is a quality of care issue or it's an efficiency.
Yeah, and I think that it can... But again, you have to take the measure of the way, and it's supposed to be for public reporting to compare across hospitals. So it's a potential solution.
Mm-hmm.
So, good. Thank you.
So on to two, on to the science. And this is probably where this comes up for me at least the most about precisely specified. So basically the criteria being eligible patients admitted ICU, and basically getting the time being the time from discharge minus the time of admission. I mean, fairly straightforward using vital signs to kind of track those start and stop times. And I think this is all pretty straightforward, pretty precisely defined, with the only caveat in my mind being this issue of where you start the ICU, if it's in the ED or in the PACU or the, you know, I mean, it's a little fuzzy, you know, hazy around the edges. And would that matter? Again, internally it wouldn't if you had a lot of variability in hospitals. And just that in a hospital infrastructure piece, is there a way to get your brain around it and describe it in some way that helps people understand whether it can be a model or not? May be hard to do. So this is probably more than anywhere else. I might, okay, I'm not sure how, hang on, let me scroll down. For me, for that reason, I put it as a P instead of a C, and I might just lay that out as just as my sort of comment. And the weakness piece is just that makes it harder to generalize and be able to say you're really solidly sure about what an ICU length of stay is if you're not entirely sure how you define an ICU.
So,
what is unclear about the how they define ICU?
Basically that, you know, it's the time, well, that how they define it is probably, it's clear. That's fair enough. So it is whether it's accurate for the entirety of the population. That'd be all.
So that you think there should be, there might be some systematic bias that certain hospitals would always have shorter length of stay because they've got these patients trapped in the ER for 24 hours. Before they ever get to the ICU.
Or longer because they're stuck in the ED or in the ICU and can't get back to the acute care. I mean, if you go a good way,
yes,
then that may be what you're getting at to some extent.
But it's a systematic, it's not a random
thing. But the trap in ER would shorten.
Mm-hmm.
So a hospital could look better if they're holding people in ERs. Is that
then
it's just that how is there, it feels like there's a hospital infrastructure issue in terms of flow that could impact this outcome measure, that internally within a hospital wouldn't matter. Would it be hard to say hospital A and B and C, this doesn't matter within all those three, even though they have different flow issues? And whether there'd be a way to, again, not trying to solve the measure problem, but to either group those hospitals, I mean, you could almost imagine hospitals with similar sort of hospital structures would be compared. You could still compare.
But part of it, I think, of what has been presented and what's been said is that if that's the issue, the hospital should fix their flow.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were looking, you know, at data, I regardless of what the problem is, I'd rather go to the hospital.
No, you wouldn't rather go to the hospital that has a shorter length of stay because you're stuck in the ED
right,
for 48
right,
hours.
Exactly. So, is that the main issue that people...
Less is not better, necessarily, if that's the main issue. Now, I don't know the size of that issue, and I cannot say that is a problem in 48% of hospitals. If it's a problem in 3% of, or 1% of all ICU admissions, forget it. Do you know?
Well, this is, again, where I don't know if you're comparing things. So how that will play out...
It has to compare across hospitals.
Yeah. No, I meant across measures. So what we're proposing at the same time a mortality measure. So if you trap the patient in the hospital, in the ED, then that will actually usually play out as worse outcomes. And first of all, it's not a huge issue. It's more of an issue sort of in February when the flu season kicks in, and it's kind of more of an issue with swine flu. But for the most part, it's not a big issue. It's not a, it's a seasonal phenomenon, not so much variation across hospitals as across time during the year. Because it's mainly respiratory waves that cause the ICU access problems. But it has not played out to be a very big issue here. But I think when you have these flow problems and you add the mortality measure, which we haven't yet discussed, then if you tried to gain your length of stay, that would probably play out within your mortality measure.
But unfortunately, you know, we have to do them as separate because we cannot be assured that the mortality measure will be used by the same people that use the length of stay. Okay, you can make it.
You can make it. Where's the record? No, not if it wasn't.
Okay.
Actually, NQF has done in the past paired measures so that you do the two together. You don't do them separately. You don't do them independently. You say if you're going to do one, you're going to do them both. And that could be a recommendation from.
Can you say that one would be paired without the other? So I don't think you want to say only do mortality if you're also willing to do length of stay. But I do think you want to say only do length of stay if you're also willing to do mortality.
So
one-way
pairing.
One-way
pairing.
Okay.
And if I could, Barbara, with respect to your concern, the smaller hospitals wouldn't be able to create a step down because they can't hire more people. If you actually have patients who are step down worthy, that actually means hiring fewer rather than more people because you take lower ratios of care when you switch, when you are able to switch people to step down.
That sounds like a good theory. You come and see our 60-bed hospital and tell me about it.
Well, you can just declare parts of, we've had hospitals just declare parts of their ICU with a step down and then go 4-to-1 now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're, you know, every hospital struggled with this at some, in some way or another. And I think to a great extent, as you're saying, I mean, you kind of need to know if this is a problem within your hospital and try to figure out what, if anything, you want to change and at what end of the flow you need to change that. It's just when you start then getting into the hospital-to-hospital comparison that gets a little trickier. So, I mean, I think maybe the pairing is a possibility if we wanted to put that as a, you know, some way to get it to kind of all balance out in the wash.
So we would say for this one, we recommend it's always paired with mortality.
If you're going to do this, you do mortality.